Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to talk with our friend Mike Merle, director of the Keystone Progress Group, about this ALEC thing we've been talking about for some time. Again, you know, when it's great when you catch these legislators cutting and pasting. When they can't seem to even do the little bit of work that we ask them to do, they've got to steal someone else's work. It'll be interesting to talk about that. In the second hour, Kenneth Dow Schmidt, going to be here, professor of labor and employment law at the Indiana University. You know, the right to work, this nonsensical attack on workers is going to happen. As I understand, August 16th, Mad Cow is going to have his House Bills 50 through 53 being argued. And this is where I think people have got to make a stand. While these hearings are going on, I'm hoping that we're going to see some blowback and maybe send a message to the not-so-radical members of the Republican Party. Look, there are a handful of extreme radicals who are pushing the Republicans in this direction, this no-rights-at-work agenda direction that Mad Cow wants to take us. And I'm saying at some point, we, all of us, need to really hammer down on them. And that means going after the moderate, the sane Republicans. And I think there are still a few left. I think there are still some who are going to say, you know what, this is a bit too extreme for Pennsylvania. Maybe you get away with this in South Carolina. Maybe you get away with this in Georgia. Not here. This is one way to get unelected. And anybody who votes for this should be unelected. Pretty simple. In the second hour, Michael Winship, he's going to be here, president of the Writers Guild of America East. He's also a senior writer and senior writing fellow at Demos. He's going to talk about the big win at the Onion. And, of course, some good class war-y stuff. Looking forward to that. In the third hour, with, again, this whole anti-worker agenda coming up, this child labor bill, tomorrow they're going to be arguing, Delosier's bill. Do we really want children working more hours? Well, we're going to talk with Norma Flores-Lopez, director of the Children in the Fields campaign at the Association of Farm Worker Opportunity Programs, about child labor. You know, we've talked about a couple days ago, we talked about the two young girls, 14 years old, electrocuted in a field, taking little tassels off of the corn stalks. I don't know what they're doing out there, but there you go, dead. 14 years old. So it'll be interesting to work through that. And, of course, talk about Cheryl Delosier's bill, wanting children to work longer. I mean, really, in this time, do we really want 14, 15, 16-year-old kids competing with their parents for jobs? I'm sorry. 14, 15-year-olds, they belong in school getting an education so that we have a country that moves forward. Just a thought. So the spin-meistering, full force. We have seen Democrats defending Obama. We have seen Republicans attacking Obama. And, you know, as you watch all this unfold, what I find interesting is what we now call victory. You know, the Republicans are, you know, on one side, there's a sliver of them calling victory. But what they're actually doing is they're saying that Obama won. And I was reading this conservative blog post this morning that caught my eye. It was titled Obama, the Big Winner in the Debt Ceiling Debate. And their rationale was that Obama got the Republicans to be very specific in the cuts that they wanted. So that they, of course, could use that in the upcoming election, and they'd be able to hold them hostage. And I agree to a degree, to a small degree, but we've always known the Republicans wanted to cut Medicare. We've always known that they've wanted to destroy Medicaid. We've always known that they've wanted to destroy the what's left of our tattered social safety net. We've known that. That's no surprise. Democrats have been running on that for several years. I think the part where this guy may be wrong is it was Obama who threw Social Security on the table. I think that that's a major problem. But the other premise of this guy's article was that this whole debate over the debt ceiling is going to be off until after the 2012 election. And somehow for him, that is a win. I'm not getting it, but that's the premise. So that's what they're telling the right. And what I find interesting, and I spent a lot of time reading right-wing blog posts and right-wing articles today, and you have to give them credit. They are masterful at playing the victim. They're masters at being the underdog. They're masters at someone stealing something from me. Masters, you know, the affirmative action thing. If it's not that, it's the taxes, because half the country doesn't pay any taxes, according to them. They're the victim. And I love that victimization. That, you know, everyone's stealing from me, or stealing my country, stealing my wealth. And it's amazing to me. And I look at one of their mouthpieces, Glenn Beck, who, again, you know, one of these really, how insane can you be? But again, it's this, we're under attack. Our values are, we're the underdog and we've got to fight back. He basically, and I'm trying to figure out how this all came about. He basically said that this whole debt ceiling talk, is just going to blow up into a full-fledged war. Because we had this debt thing passed, now we're going to get into World War III. He says, we're entering the beginnings of what I believe, Glenn Beck believes, is World War III. He says, please, I hope I'm wrong. Hope I'm laughing with you about it in 5 years. But if you look at what's happening with Russia and the rest of the world, we and NATO and the rest of the West is being set up in Libya. And this time the Axis forces have all the chips. And I'm going, Axis forces, what are you talking about? The Nazi Axis, are you talking about Japan, Germany, Italy? Or are you talking about the Bush Axis, Iran, Iraq, North Korea? I'm not seeing them with all the chips. But again, facts don't matter. Reality doesn't matter. We're the underdogs. And the reality in this whole discussion is the real underdog here. The real honest-to-goodness underdog is the American worker who's been getting screwed for 30 years. This debate over the debt did absolutely nothing to make my life any better. It did nothing to make your life any better. There are going to be fewer jobs because of it. There's going to be less help when jobs are lost because of it. And there are going to be more costs for struggling families. So, in my opinion, everything we did here, wrong. We should be investing in infrastructure. We should be getting people back to work. And nobody during this whole discussion talked about if we could get those 14 million people back on the job, paying taxes into the coffers, our debt problems would solve themselves. If we could do something with that trade deficit that we have had since 1975, the last year this country saw a trade surplus. If we could do something about that, all of our debt problems would solve themselves, because you would have good-paying jobs, manufacturing jobs that paid into the coffers. So when the president came out to give his, you know, pat on the back speech, again, it was one of those moments where I go, well, here we go. Here comes the trade thing. And he did not fail. The president says he wants Congress to pass a set of trade deals. Quote, deals we've already negotiated that will help displace workers looking for a new job and would allow businesses to sell more products in countries, Asia and South America. Products that are stamped with the words made in America. And I'm going, really? Is that the hope here? Because as I see these trade deals, each one of them comes with a large number of job losses, comes with more manufacturing leaving the country, comes with more offshoring of profits. I mean, you look at Panama, I think that's going to be a major tax haven. But we're not talking about that stuff. And the Republicans, they're holding up. Why? Well, they don't want to put the trade adjustment assistance in there. And I make the argument, if the Republicans think this is going to create jobs, why not put the TAA in there? Going to have more jobs. Because they know. And they absolutely know. Like NAFTA, American workers are going to get screwed. The underdogs in all of this. And the fact of the matter is you look at, Republicans were happy. They're happy. They got what they wanted. And they were happy enough to go on vacation for 5 weeks while they left some 4,000 FAA employees hanging out on the street. They left some 4,000 FAA employees on the unemployment line. Not to mention the $2.5 billion in transportation projects that are no longer being worked on. So you're seeing another, I've seen numbers between 90 and 200,000 construction workers on the unemployment line. How is that helping our debt any? So after all of this talk that we need to cut spending, all of this talk that, oh, we're so worried about the debt, they go on vacation and let the airline industry pocket some $30 million a day in uncollected airline taxes. Because as you've noticed and as we've talked about, they raise their prices. So they're not collecting the tax anymore. They just raise the prices. Why? Because you're used to paying it. And as I've been saying all through this whole Republican-created crisis, this was never about deficits. It's not about debt. This is very Machiavellian. This is about punishing the opposition. This is about punishing working people and punishing the poor. That's what this is about. And anytime one of these folks say, well, gee, you know, we care about the debt and the deficit, look at who ran it up. Look at where the debt came from. During the Reagan years, our debt ceiling was raised 199.5% from the time he took office until he left. To me, says it all. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with our good friend Mike Morrill, executive director of Keystone Progress, about this new report that they've come out with. It's going to knock your socks off. You're going to want to stick around for this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. $200 million per week. That's how much money the shutdown of the Federal Aviation Administration is costing the federal government. Not only is it increasing the federal deficit, which Republicans have fought so hard to reduce in the debt ceiling fight, it also leaves 4,000 workers furloughed and is having ripple effects on nearly 90,000 related contract jobs. The FAA has been shut down over new rules that could make it easier for workers to form unions. But Association of Flight Attendants President Vita Shook says that isn't the reason her union wants the FAA back on the job.
This is not about stacking the deck for unions. It's about basic democratic principles of fair elections. The bottom line is that real people are getting hurt because of Republican political gain.
During a conference call, Shook listed a number of projects that are stalled due to the shutdown, such as installing a seismic sensor at an airport in Anchorage, and efforts to modernize control towers throughout the country.
$2.5 billion. That's the total scale of airport construction projects on hold due to the FAA shutdown throughout the nation.
70,000 to 90,000 additional workers are being impacted by the shutdown of the FAA's construction projects. In addition, failure to pass the larger reauthorization bill is impeding job creation.
280,000. That's the number of jobs that would be created by passing a multi-year FAA reauthorization bill. And the last number, 20. 20 is the number of times a clean extension for funding the FAA has been passed while we continue to debate the larger reauthorization bill.
We Are Ohio's campaign to repeal the gutting of public worker collective bargaining is maintaining the high energy and huge volume of volunteers that gathered more petition signatures than any other effort in Ohio history, Doug Cunningham reports.
Twice as many signatures as needed have been validated, and the repeal of SB 5, the Republican bill attacking public worker collective bargaining, will be on Ohio's November ballot. Melissa Fizikas of We Are Ohio says the group's focus now is maintaining the momentum, the energy, and the 10,000-plus volunteers working on this campaign to defend collective bargaining rights.
We woke up on June 30th, the day after we delivered those signatures, in the second phase of our campaign, ready to go. We have more than 10,000 volunteers who were on the ground collecting signatures, and all of those people are saying to us, what's next? How can I remain involved? How can I keep helping? And what are we going to do to make sure that we repeal this bill in November?
Fizikas says this SB 5 repeal effort clearly demonstrates that Ohio's people are against radical moves to destroy labor rights.
Extreme politicians went too far with this bill, and they want an opportunity to repeal it in November.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
I'm just an average man with an average life. I work from 9 to 5. Hey, hell, I pay the price. All I want is to be left alone in my average home. But why do I always feel like I'm in the twilight zone? And I always feel like somebody's watching me.
So you look at the debate that's going on, was going on in Washington, and a lot of people upset about it. And to be honest, considerable anger is rightly placed. Many are looking at our elected leaders and asking, you know, why aren't you doing your job? Why aren't you doing what we're paying you for? And, you know, that line of questioning often pops up in crisis, but we should be asking that all the time. And, you know, I look at the legislative process, and I remember as a kid learning on Schoolhouse Rock, because that's where I got most of my education during that time, Saturday morning cartoons. They had this thing, I'm Just a Bill, and it laid out how a law was kind of made. It's kind of how my mind worked. They said, you know, when folks back home had an idea, somebody back there said, there should be a law, and the congressman said, yep, you're right, we're going to pass it. But it started with an idea at home, in their districts, dealing with people, their constituents. You know, I'm thinking that maybe we need to rewrite Schoolhouse Rock and, you know, look at it as a little bit, a little updating, saying, you know, the idea started in some boardroom. Some executive wanted a law. And they wrote it for a congressman who said, that'll be $5,000 for my campaign. Because that seems to be where we're going with this. So you look at this Alex scenario, this American Legislative Exchange Council who, according to the folks at Keystone Progress, have been doing the work of our legislators. That's why I've asked Mike Morrell, Executive Director of Keystone Progress, to come talk to us about his release today. Mike, thanks for taking time for us.
Great to be back here, Rick. Wonderful show as always, and good bumper music too.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm looking at this and explain what is, first of all, what is ALEC?
ALEC is the American Legislative Exchange Council. And it sounds innocuous enough, and what the way that they describe themselves is as a nonprofit charitable organization that brings legislators and other folks together to talk about public policy and to craft some ideas. But in reality, it's a big business-sponsored organization that should not be a 501c3 charitable organization because it is really doing lobbying. The way it works is they do bring together legislators and other folks, but those other folks are all corporate lobbyists. They have two divisions. They have the corporate lobbyist division, and they have the legislators division. And the way that they work is end up crafting legislation, but it's not where people get together and share ideas. What happens is they come together a couple of times a year, but in their meeting, the corporate lobbyists have their separate meeting. They sit down and literally behind closed doors. This is all really the way it happens. We always talk about behind closed doors and that kind of stuff. And they write the legislation. Then once they're done writing it, they give it to the legislative committee, and the legislators can vote up or down whether or not they want to accept it. But that's the way it works. So they've written lots of legislation. This year they have 800 different bills that they have written, and many of them are making their way into our legislative process all over the country, and especially here in Pennsylvania.
So when I say, you know, you look at what happened in Wisconsin and Ohio and Michigan and Florida and Maine and all across the country, when I say, you know, that it looks like someone wrote a playbook and they're just passing it around, This is exactly what you're talking about.
Well, it's more than just a playbook, because there are a lot of playbooks out there. And let's be honest, on both sides of the aisle, there are people who craft legislation. They give talking points, they give agendas and the kinds of things that they want. Unions do it, and that's a good thing. I mean, you talked about Schoolhouse Rock, and that's the way it should work. Everybody should share their ideas and give them to legislators. But this is one step beyond that. They don't just share ideas. They actually write the legislation, and then very lazy legislators, including many here in Pennsylvania, take that and use that verbatim. They don't even bother to change a word.
Basically just cut and paste.
It's exactly cut and paste.
When I was in school, there was a word for that. And it usually got you thrown out of school. Plagiarism.
Right.
I guess we don't have a problem with legislators plagiarizing?
Well, the legislators themselves don't seem to have a problem with it, because we released our report today, and a lot of local newspapers did some pretty good stories, actually, some accurate coverage of what we released. And when they asked legislators, the legislators said, everybody does this. And you talk about kids in high school cheating. That's what kids in high school always say when they get caught. Everybody's cheating, so why can't I do it, too?
Everybody's doing it, so let's make it legal. So if that's the position that they're going to take, we don't really need them. Why not get rid of the middleman?
Well, especially in Pennsylvania, I don't think that this is legitimate anywhere, but you can almost understand it, where you have a state that has a truly part-time legislator, and there are some small states that have, they only meet 3 months a year.
Right.
Somebody's a farmer 3 months, and they're a legislator. I mean, a farmer 9 months a year, and they're a legislator 3 months a year. They don't have any staff. They don't have any support. So to have somebody who's going to write a bill for them, again, you can almost understand it. It's still, I think, unethical.
I think it's wrong, but
I agree.
Almost.
But in Pennsylvania, there's absolutely no excuse. We have more staffers than any other state per legislator than California. And so they have all of these guys and gals who are out there. What are they doing? They're supposed to be writing legislation. They're supposed to be serving us. They don't do anything. So it's even worse in Pennsylvania.
So take me to one of these ALEC meetings, because I've got this vision in my head, and maybe you can help me here. I got this vision that you've painted, that you've got these lobbyists, these corporate-controlled puppets, who are writing corporate-controlled legislation, the business-friendly stuff, while our legislators are drinking, partying, carrying on, playing golf, doing whatever. That's the image I've got.
That's it.
So that's it.
That's it. What happens? And they're meeting tomorrow. They're starting tomorrow in New Orleans. And there are lots of ethical questions that are raised by this, too. So your image of what happens is pretty accurate. They get down and they meet, and they have some joint sessions, but the actual business is done in separate rooms. So the corporate lobbyists all get together, and they've already pretty much crafted what they want. So the insurance folks come together, and they say, hey, we want this bill, and this bill. The anti-immigration folks say, we want these things to happen. And so all the different folks who are, again, all corporate lobbyists, they craft the legislation, and they say, what do you think? Should we pass this one? And they say yes. So they take that legislation that they've written, and then they send it across the hall to the legislators where they're meeting. And the legislators, when they have their meeting, can vote up or down on those bills, and then that's it. But the rest of the time, they do. They have a golf outing. They're encouraged to bring their families, and there's nothing wrong with that. If I go on a trip, I want to bring my family if I can. But the difference is that I pay for it.
Right.
If there's an event that I have to go for Keystone Progress, and I want to bring my family, I pay for the extra for the room. I pay for their transportation. I pay for their meals personally, not Keystone Progress. The problem that we're having here is that up until a couple of years ago, some of the legislators at least were honest and paid for it out of their campaign coffers. Now that has stopped. None of them are doing that anymore. And that means there are only two real options left. That means either the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania is paying for it, which I think is illegal, or ALEC is paying for it. And we know that both of those things have happened in some cases, because today Seth Grove out of York admitted that his ALEC dues were being paid for by the Commonwealth. And Daryl Metcalf, one of your favorite people, has admitted that ALEC has sponsored him and paid for him to go to meetings.
And we don't have an ethical problem with that. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here talking with Mike Morrill. He's the executive director of Keystone Progress. KeystoneProgress.org is the website. If you want to take a look at this report, this is just amazing stuff. You know, walk me through some of this, because you know, the image of this to me is that you know you have the law that is being cut and paste. And I don't even know that the legislators then understand what it is if you're just taking someone else's work and putting it forth. To me, it seems very dishonest, very disingenuous. But do you have any examples?
I've got some great examples. There's HB 250. which is one that you would love. It's called the Council on Efficient Government Act. And that's a wonderful piece of legislation. It sounds like, who doesn't want efficient government? Well, it's crafted by ALEC, and their title is the Council on Efficient Government Act. And when Seth Grove from York introduced it, he called his the Council on Efficient Government Act. But he didn't go that, he didn't just stop there in copying ALEC. He literally copied everything along the way. The Council on Efficient Government Act, the real purpose is to figure out which government services they can privatize. So anything that isn't being efficient and doesn't compare positively with the private sector should therefore be turned over to the private sector. That's what its purpose is. Now, you would think that a bill like that, if they wanted to introduce something like that in concept, they would have some talking points, they would have some general parameters. But again, they did word for word, step by step, to the point where the number of members of the council is identical. The way that people get in the wording for how the members are appointed, disqualification, what they can and can't get reimbursed for, everything down to the every single word is the same, except for a couple of exceptions. One where the model legislation says insert state here, and the other one says Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, the one that was actually introduced in the House of Representatives.
And I'm sure they probably highlighted that to make sure that the changes were made.
They did. They put it in brackets and bolded it.
So when I look at our tweet of the day, which came from Representative Grove, he said, I'm a member of ALEC because I believe in limited government, free markets, and states' rights. Limited government, when I hear that whole small government argument, I think inefficient, ineffective. I look at this, it seems pretty inefficient to me.
Well, it is. And if he really believes in small government, he should lay off all of his staff because he obviously doesn't need them to do any of the work because somebody else is writing all the legislation for him.
So who funds this ALEC group? I mean, where's the money coming from? Because at the end of the day, what it seems like to me is we've got a bunch of people on the payroll over there. And then the second part of this question is, how pervasive is this? How many of our legislators are involved in this group?
Well, let me start with the funding part first, because that's the one of the other outrageous things. It sounds like it's a membership organization, and there are lots of membership organizations where the membership pays the hefty portion of it, and the dues do that. Unions, all that money comes from workers, and they voluntarily join a union, and they give their dues money because that's they want to make sure that they have good representation. That's not the case with ALEC. ALEC has, if you're a legislator, you know what it costs to join? $50 every 2 years. So that's $25 a year to join this organization. So 98% of the money comes from corporations and big foundations. Who are those foundations and corporations? Well, in Pennsylvania, Richard Mellon Scaife is one of the big contributors. The Koch brothers are one of the big contributors. The biggest donor of this current year with over $1.5 million is ExxonMobil. The health insurance industry. If you go through the list, there are tens of millions of dollars that are being spent on this, and the legislators spend almost nothing. So when they go to these events, they don't pay for this. This is all sponsored by the corporations. The luncheons are paid for by the corporations. Their golf outing is paid by the corporations, and they do some good things at this. They encourage families to come, which I, again, think is a great thing. But they paid over $150,000 this past year for child care. Who's paying for that child care?
That's a good question. And at the end of this, look, I believe in family values, too. Just not on my dime, on my official dime.
Exactly.
I look at this, and to be honest, Mike, you know, what frustrates me when I see this is I'm someone who believes in government of form by we the people. And when you see stories like this, the right wing does this stuff, and it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. They do these things, and then we get outraged by the fact that they're not doing their work, they're plagiarizing, they're doing all this stuff, and then we, as we're kind of doing right now, say, look, government's broken. And it falls right into their frame, to that anti-government frame. And I make the argument that, you know, the way they run government is broken. Not the way I would do it.
Well, of course, if you don't believe in government, then how can you run government? It's silly. I don't understand people who say that they don't like government and then run for office. That's absurd to me.
Well, what's absurd to me is that someone would vote for them going, I'm going to destroy your government. I am going to cut services. I am going to slash spending to education. I'm going to slash programs for the poor. And in the process, I'm going to privatize public education and privatize your wine and spirit shops, your assets, and what the heck, everything else we can find as well while raising your property taxes.
And that's who they vote for, and that's exactly the agenda of ALEC. They make no bones about trying to destroy unions. They make no bones about trying to destroy public education. They make no bones about trying to destroy voters' rights. There's bill after bill in there on how to do that. And all the things that you've been talking about for the last couple of years, not just the last year, but for years, I bet that 90% of those bills that you've been talking about that have been taking place here in Pennsylvania or in Congress or in Wisconsin and other states, those things originated with ALEC.
I know you used the example of three bills in your press release, and you report that 23 legislators are members of ALEC. How many bills, I mean, have you done more research into this, of how many more beyond these three that you can identify as the cut and paste, hey, we took sections here, or we stole someone else's work?
Well, the examples that we gave, and we only gave examples side by side in our report of four different bills, and that's because those were bills. First of all, there are 800 ALEC bills this year. There are about 2,000 in the General Assembly.
Right.
We have a staff of 2.5. So how are we? We don't have the staff.
No, I'm just asking.
So we wanted to give just an example.
Right.
But even in our limited research, those four bills that we used were things where it was literally 95 to almost 100% that was identical. We didn't give examples where there were just sections or paragraphs where it was clearly word for word where the ideas came from ALEC. We only gave where it was so outrageous, so egregious that you couldn't help but notice that they didn't do any work whatsoever.
So you're talking about 800 bills right now.
Right.
And they've been doing this for a number of years, because I've been saying for the longest time, what's gone on is we've basically ceded control of our government to corporate special interests with all this talk of we need to be more business friendly. When they're writing the legislation that's supposed to regulate themselves, I don't know how much more business friendly we need to be. Maybe like the Colombians where they throw union members out of planes, maybe that would be business friendly enough, although I'm not sure.
I'm not sure either, but their own website brags that they passed, that the bills that they introduce into legislatures around the country get passed about 100 to 200 bills a year. So that's
staggering.
That's 4 to 8 per state, and most states don't have that many. But we don't know how many have happened in Pennsylvania, but because they're a very secretive organization, because they're organized as a 501c3, they don't have to reveal any of this information. The only reason we have any of this, the only reason we know what kind of sample legislation that they have put out there, is because the Center on Media and Democracy put up a website. They found all of this information, exposed it, and publicized it on a website called alecexposed.org. That's the only reason we know that. And the only reason we know what legislators are out there is because we did the research on that. We went to the Department of State website and found out who was paying their own freight to become members of ALEC. We looked for newspaper articles. We looked for their legislative websites. We looked for, in a couple of cases, their law firm's websites. So we identified 23 people. I actually believe there are at least 50 members, Republican members of the General Assembly in Pennsylvania alone, who are members of ALEC.
Wow. That's scary stuff. And what really more frightening is the secret nature of it. Almost the whole, during the Bush years, they were talking about the secret clubs that he was, the secret societies. This is right under our nose.
Right.
And here you go. So what do we do? How do we turn this around? How do we find out who's done what? How do we hold those accountable who have plagiarized this stuff? What's the plan here? I mean, you guys have written a great piece, and of course you can find that over at keystoneprogress.org, but what's the plan?
This is just the first step. We uncovered a little bit of this, and we piqued the interest of some of the mainstream media. Today, on a lot of the daily newspaper blogs and a couple of radio stations, we got some good coverage, and we got this wonderful story tonight out on the Rick Smith Show. Tomorrow, a lot of the daily newspapers all over Pennsylvania will be doing that and confronting their legislators. And some of the legislators slipped and admitted, Seth Grove, for instance, admitted that he had his ALEC dues paid for by the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, which, again, I think is illegal. So we've begun to get the interest, and I think that what's going to happen is more and more media outlets will be able to get some more interest. But we're also filing tomorrow right-to-know requests under the right-to-know law in Pennsylvania, asking for some of this information. We want to know how much Alec, how many scholarships Alec has given to people. So if they're giving scholarships, if family members are going on Alec's dime, that's stuff that has to be reported on ethics forms. We haven't seen those yet, so we want to see all of those. But we also want to see all of the expenditures that the General Assembly or any entity in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania is giving to Alec. So we want to see any checks that have been cut to the American Legislative Exchange Council by the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. So we're doing a right-to-know request on both of those counts and trying to find out whether Alec is giving money to legislators and their families and if the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania is paying for it. We believe both are the case.
Well, thank goodness you're on this case, and thank goodness there's somebody paying attention. But at the end of this, you know, the people who are responsible, we need to deal with. But again, you know, this is one of those scenarios where the very people who are against government are the very people who are running it into the ground so they can turn around and say that, look, it's broken because we broke it.
Right. Absolutely.
Again, KeystoneProgress.org is the website. A great report. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. What do you think about this? Should we be paying their dues? Is this a good thing, cut and paste legislation? Right back after this.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Score another bold-faced demerit for the corporate lickspittles in Congress. This time, they delivered a slap to workers while simultaneously delivering their corporate overseers a cash bonanza. At issue was legislation to fund the Federal Aviation Administration. At the behest of airline lobbyists, Republican House leaders stopped the normal funding process by insisting on stripping airline workers of their right to form unions. This asinine game-playing meant that, on June 24th, America's essential airline safety agency began a shutdown that threatens about 36,000 workers, including safety inspectors, with layoffs. Another proud moment for airline greedheads and Republican boneheads. But, claimed the boneheads, consumers would benefit because the shutdown meant that FAA had to stop collecting the 7.5% tax on airline tickets, thus saving flyers up to $50 per round trip. Ha! Fat chance of consumers ever catching a break from this gang. Sure enough, the week before the shutdown, airline honchos quietly began raising ticket prices by, you guessed it, 7.5% or more. So, the $50 per ticket that is supposed to help maintain and improve our nation's air travel infrastructure, instead, is siphoned straight into the bank accounts of American Airlines, Delta, Frontier, JetBlue, Southwest, and U.S. Air. Their ripoff adds up to some $30 million a day. This is Jim Hightower saying, perhaps you assume that this ripoff will stop once the FAA is back in action. Ha, again. Airline CEOs are nimble-fingered pickpockets who keep inventing new schemes for lifting money from workers and customers alike. They have no intention of rolling back this corporate tax. To help fight these greedheads, contact Transportation Workers Union, TWU.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. You know, the more I hear about that, the more frustrated I get. We're paying legislators to basically do nothing, to be handed their work. It's everything that angers me about government. It's everything that I think ticks people off in general. It's that whole entitlement, that whole elitist class, that whole cesspool, if you will. And what frustrates me is, you know, you look at poll after poll after poll when they talk about Congress and they say, oh, Congress stinks. 28-30% of the people only approve of Congress. Everybody else, oh, they all stink. But my guy's aces. And that's one of those really frustrating things, because then you keep sending the same people back and back and back. You know, I look at Mad Cow. I don't know how anybody sends him, as radical as he is, I don't know how anybody sends him here.
Mike touched on something. He talked about the powerful people who fund it. When you look at what's happening across the country, there absolutely is a direct correlation, because the Koch and the Mellon Scaifes have been funding these right-wing groups, and I'm sure they're involved in every state we're talking about. They're in Wisconsin, they're in Michigan, they're in New Jersey, they're in Pennsylvania, they're in Ohio. And there is a direct tie-in, and the national media has talked about Alec. At least some of the progressive stations have, I should say networks have. And there is a direct tie-in between Pennsylvania and what's happening everywhere else. It's almost as if, and according to Mike, that's exactly what they do. They cut and paste. Almost word for word.
Well, you know, you say that there's a playbook, and what he's saying is, no, it's more than a playbook. It's they're actually going, here's the legislation. A playbook is kind of an outline. This is actually the law. And, you know, I don't care what side of the aisle you're on. At the end of the day, this is not good for we the people. This is not good for our government. It's good for their campaign coffers. It's good for business, not good for us. And, again, you know, I keep hearing this, we need to be more business-friendly. Well, how much more business-friendly do we have to be than to allow them to write the law that's supposed to be watching over them? It's just, it's incestuous.
Well, whatever voter should worry about is what you're doing is allowing your democracy to slip out of your fingers. Look, these legislators can have, this is America, we might disagree with them, we might even hate them for their political views, but they have the right to political views. But what they don't have the right is to allow powerful forces to basically tell them what they're going to support and tell them what to say, and that's exactly what they're doing. Now they'll say, oh, no, we just take their advice, and we listen to what they say. I mean, let's be honest. They pretty much accept, and some of them accept almost 100%, and that is very, very disconcerting. We keep going this direction, and we are absolutely going to lose our democracy, and we're going to lose an effective government. And that has a dramatic effect on the quality of life at the end of the day for every Pennsylvanian, and that should be troubling to every voter.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. I got an email from Jeb. He says, I called my Secretary of State and asked about political parties. He says she mentioned the Republicans, Democrats, Independents, and others. There was no mention of a Tea Party. Will you please stop dignifying these loathsome wackos by calling them a party? Repeat after me. He says, teabagger, teabagger, teabagger. Was that so hard? No, Jeb, that wasn't hard. And thank you for the correction. The reality is our media has given them so much attention, too much in my opinion, and assigned them too much power, that, you know, you look at, and I talked about this a little bit the other night. I was watching C-SPAN, and they had this Tea Express woman on, Amy something or other, I think, and she, I mean, really, honestly and truthfully, she had about as much business being interviewed as an expert on the economy as I have talking about astrophysics. She had no business, yet there she was, plastered on my idiot screen, being asked questions as if she had an answer, only to prove to the nation that she really didn't have an answer. But this is what's happened with this whole movement. And I can't even call it a movement anymore. It's a paid advertisement, because this woman is making big bucks. They have put her out there because she looks like, you know, she looks like my next door neighbor. And that's the mastery of what the right has been able to do. You know, in using the old Jay Gould quote, I can easily pay half the country to kill the other half. Back when they were shooting people. Now, you know, then they moved to the just beating them upstage, and now they've got their briefcases. And everything they do with a smile. And I look at this woman and I go, you know, she's talking about, you know, well, we need a balanced budget amendment, yet I have no idea what it is. And this is exactly the kind of stuff that I'm talking about with this Alex stuff. You've got people putting out legislation who don't know what it is. You know, when you sit down and you craft something, and this was the great thing about statesmen of the past. They would sit down and they would write a piece of legislation. They knew that piece of legislation, top to bottom, front to back. What's happened now, we've got lobbyists and we've got trade groups and we've got groups like this ALEC. We've got all of these people doing the work. And it's on both sides of the aisle at some point. But the majority of it is on the business side. The business people are the one putting this. I don't know any homeless advocates who are out there writing legislation for the homeless. I don't know people who are starving who have lobbyists who are writing legislation to put through to support food banks. Not seeing that. I am seeing huge corporations who need to pollute more. I am seeing huge corporations who want to repatriate all the profits they have overseas. I'm seeing them doing a lot of writing. And groups like this, ALEC, are they the ones who are handing these legislators the information, handing them the legislation in its full form? Well, according to Mike, absolutely. Sad, sad day. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
Smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
With a PSECU home equity line of credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, you've got a rate so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer is a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing light is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseCU.com/leg.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask Me Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Sanity, fresh age. The Rick Smith Show.
Well, here's a pack at you. You're gonna choke on it too. You're gonna lose.
520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, our podcast is right there. Also, if you got a smartphone, you can just download the Stitcher app and look for The Rick Smith Show. Yesterday, we talked a little bit about Representative Doug Lamborn, a Republican from Colorado. He said something really stupid. Well, let's play with what he said. Pretty simple.
Even if some people say, well, the Republicans should have done this or they should have done that, they will hold the president responsible. Now, I don't want to even have to be associated with him. It's like touching a tar baby and you get it. You know, you're stuck and you're part of the problem now.
I like associating with the president. It's like being touched by a tar baby. yeah, I took a little heat over that. He apologized, as you knew he was going to. He says he regrets that he chose the phrase tar baby rather than the word quagmire. And I'm kind of thinking about that for a second. I'm going, let's see, tar baby, quagmire. I've read the Uncle Remus stories. I don't ever remember the word quagmire being in there when talking about a tar baby. Sorry, just not there. He goes on to say the congressman is confident that the president will accept his heartfelt apology. I don't know about that. And I look at this story that, and really, what's really sad about this is, yeah, he says he's sorry and it goes on. Yeah, whatever. Just one more idiot racist. You look at this CBS affiliate in Chicago, WBBM. Evidently, they were trying to, you know, do a story on this drive-by shooting of two teenagers in a Chicago neighborhood. And they went out and got some footage, you know, so they could put into their little story. And, well, they... here's what the little kid had. They had this little four-year-old kid that they put on camera, and they were coaxing him into saying stuff.
And kids on the street, as young as four, were there to see it all unfold and had a disturbing reaction.
No, I'm not scared of nothing.
When you get older, you gonna stay away from all these guns?
No.
No?
No.
What do you want to do when you get older?
I'm gonna have me a gun.
So that's what they played. So they said, I'm not afraid of nothing. And when I get older, I'm gonna have me a gun. Here is what the actual footage was before they decided they were gonna do a little chopping.
When you get older, you gonna stay away from all these guns?
No.
No?
No.
What do you want to do when you get older?
I'm gonna have me a gun.
You are? Why do you want to do that? You know what you
have to do? I'm gonna be the police.
Okay, well then you can have one.
They forgot to put that part that the kid wanted to have a gun so he could be a cop. And you gotta love how they cut and paste this stuff. Very much like the, the guy who dressed up like a pimp. Remember him? Very much in that, the Breitbart-esque type editing. Where, you know, it's not even really good editing. It just, you know, cut out just a piece we need. I
call that yellow journalism.
Well, it's a whole lot of something.
A setup.
It is a whole lot of something. And, you know, the reality in all this is what frustrates me. Is it just gets passed off. Oh, well, it was a mistake. Kind of like the thing in Wisconsin where the Koch brothers front group, Americans for Prosperity, decided that they were going to send out a mailer, to remind people to vote and send out the stuff to, hey, make sure you vote on, August 11th. Make sure you get your ballot in by August 11th, except it's August 9th. Knowing that a few people, they were going to get to send it in late. And there's just saying, oh, well, gee, it's a typo. I would understand, and I got to be honest, I would understand a typo that said 10123456789. I would understand that. I can understand a one-digit typo because it's August 9th, right? So if it was a typo, you'd type the 8th. Oops, made a mistake. It was a typo, you hit the 0. Oops, it was a mistake. It's right there on the keyboard. But two digits, 1-1. How did you get 1-1 out of the 9th? How is that a typo? I understand typos. I make thousands of them. I got big fingers. Sometimes I hit two keys at once. I get that. Fully get it. But our friends at the Koch brother group somehow want us to buy into this. Oh, it was a mistake. It was a typo. Just an honest typo. Anyone could have done it. Al Gore, former vice president, and the founder of Current TV was on with Keith Olbermann, and he said money plays way too big a role now. Gee, big surprise there. He said more than three-quarters of all campaign money raised in both political parties is now spent on 30-second television ads, and that amount goes up every year. He said the only place they can raise that much money on a regular, continuing basis is from the special interest and business lobbies, and they end up calling the tune. And, you know, okay, Al, you know, our government's broken. It's in real trouble, like you said, and you're just now figuring that out. Congratulations, Al. It only took you 10.5 years to figure that out. I would have figured it out when I got screwed during the election of 2000. And I go back to that moment. This would be an entirely different country. This would be an entirely different world if that day goes differently. If you don't have a Supreme Court of activist Supreme Court justices who decided that, you know what, it is their role to anoint the king. It was their role to anoint George W. Bush. This would be a very different place. And we're still digging out of that mess. And I got to be honest, it's one of those things that's frustrating on a whole wide number of levels.
And don't you get the impression, Rick, that, and we talked about it, you know, the corporations and especially the wealthy, they enjoyed tremendous, tremendous success under Bush. And they just don't want to, they don't want to change that. They don't want to give back, even though part of them has to know that, you know, in the big picture, the tax breaks that they got and the gifts that Congress gave corporate America isn't good for the country. It's just a matter of pure, unadulterated greed, and they don't want to give it back. And we'll fight to their last dollar. And that is disconcerting, and I got to tell you, President Obama is, because of what he did, I think he's put himself in some jeopardy. If the Republicans can come up with a decent candidate, right now they don't have one, I got to admit that. I don't think Romney's the challenger, but if the Republicans can come up with a decent candidate, I'm afraid that the president's going to have his hands full. I just saw a poll today, Rick. Believe it or not, he's only 1 point ahead of Rick Santorum. Yep. He's several points ahead of Romney. But Rick Santorum, 1 point? Are you kidding me? If I were in the Obama administration, I'd start looking. I understand we're a little ways out. We're a year and 3 months out. But those kind of numbers should be very, very troubling to that administration. They need to mend some fences, and Obama needs to change.
Well, all comes back down to jobs. All comes back down to jobs. And as we've been saying for the longest time here, ever since November, the attacks are going to be starting here in Pennsylvania. They're ramping up here. Tomorrow is the hearing on the child labor bill. Going to let kids work longer. It's mind-boggling to me that we would pursue this, but tomorrow's going to be the beginning of HB 2927, Cheryl DeLozier's bill. We're also going to be talking about the No Rights at Work agenda next week, August 16th. So all of those insane right-to-work bills are going to be coming up. When we come back, we're going to talk with Kenneth Schmidt, professor of labor and employment law at the Indiana University, about the No Rights at Work agenda that's going through the state of Indiana, how that's going to look here in Pennsylvania, and how we can stop it. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
$200 million per week. That's how much money the shutdown of the Federal Aviation Administration is costing the federal government. Not only is it increasing the federal deficit, which Republicans have fought so hard to reduce in the debt ceiling fight, it also leaves 4,000 workers furloughed and is having ripple effects on nearly 90,000 related contract jobs. The FAA has been shut down over new rules that could make it easier for workers to form unions. But Association of Flight Attendants President Vita Shook says that isn't the reason her union wants the FAA back on the job.
This is not about stacking the deck for unions. It's about basic democratic principles of fair elections. The bottom line is that real people are getting hurt because of Republican political games.
During a conference call, Shook listed a number of projects that are stalled due to the shutdown, such as installing a seismic sensor at an airport in Anchorage and efforts to modernize control towers throughout the country.
$2.5 billion. That's the total scale of airport construction projects on hold due to the FAA shutdown throughout the nation.
70,000 to 90,000 additional workers are being impacted by the shutdown of the FAA's construction projects. In addition, failure to pass the larger reauthorization bill is impeding job creation.
280,000. That's the number of jobs that would be created by passing a multi-year FAA reauthorization bill. And the last number, 20. 20 is the number of times a clean extension for funding the FAA has been passed while we continue to debate a larger reauthorization bill.
We Are Ohio's campaign to repeal the gutting of public worker collective bargaining is maintaining the high energy and huge volume of huge number of volunteers that gathered more petition signatures than any other effort in Ohio history, Doug Cunningham reports.
Twice as many signatures as needed have been validated, and the repeal of SB 5, the Republican bill attacking public worker collective bargaining, will be on Ohio's November ballot. Melissa Fizikas of We Are Ohio says the group's focus now is maintaining the momentum, the energy, and the 10,000-plus volunteers working on this campaign to defend collective bargaining rights.
We woke up on June 30th, the day after we delivered those signatures, in the second phase of our campaign, ready to go. We have more than 10,000 volunteers who were on the ground collecting signatures, and all of those people are saying to us, what's next? How can I remain involved? How can I keep helping? And what are we going to do to make sure that we repeal this bill in November?
Fizikas says this SB 5 repeal effort clearly demonstrates that Ohio's people are against radical moves to destroy labor rights.
Extreme politicians went too far with this bill, and they want an opportunity to repeal it in November.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Your working class radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Working hard to make a living, rich and prosperous. Father, son, left the cameo, blue dental, head is fake. Oh, he's a working class man.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. You know, in the coming weeks, the radical right-wing assault on workers' rights is coming to the Pennsylvania Capitol here in Harrisburg. The radicals on the right wing of the Republican Party, they're pushing their no rights at work agenda. You know, as I've been warning for months, and the date, mark your calendars, August 16th, there are going to be public hearings planned for Daryl Metcalf's, or as I call him, Mad Cow's, HB 50 through 53. That's the no rights at work agenda. That's stripping collective bargaining rights away. That's a whole bunch of ugliness right there that he's proposing. And I suggest if you've got time on the 16th, they're going to be holding their hearing from 1 to 4 p.m. Here in the Capitol. I say come down and have your voices heard. It's time for activists to stand up and be heard. It's time for working people to stand up and be heard. And across the country, we've seen this attack. And across the country, people like in Ohio and then like in Indiana have stood up and said, you know what? No. And one of those folks who has stood up, Professor Kenneth Dow Schmidt, a professor of labor and employment law at Indiana University, published a piece across the state of Indiana, union security is middle class security. Professor, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks for having me on. I'm glad to talk about this important subject.
Well, I appreciate people who are willing to stand up and be activists and say, you know what, what's being pushed out in the mainstream corporate-controlled media is flat-out dead wrong. The direction that the radicals are taking this country, dead wrong. And it's nice to hear somebody standing up for average, everyday working people.
Well, thanks. I really feel like the current agenda has kind of forced me to take voice. I mean, they certainly have stepped. I mean, you know, we've seen it's been a coordinated attack, really. We know about the Koch brothers, and we know about ALEC, what the American Legislative Exchange Council and his funding of that group and the Cato Institute and how they've tried to coordinate legislation across the country to take away people's collective bargaining rights.
Yeah, in fact, the folks here at Keystone Progress just published a piece about our legislators here in Pennsylvania, and we're in regard to ALEC, 23 members that they can identify, and four pieces of legislation basically cut and paste from ALEC's playbook into legislation that they're claiming as their own. To me, it's criminal.
Yeah. Well, you know, when the Supreme Court tells us that money equals free speech, I guess billionaires like the Koch brothers get a lot more speech than the rest of us.
No, I guess.
And you know, when they can lobby legislators and help them help support their elections, we know that the Koch brothers supported the election of Governor Walker in Wisconsin and Governor Scott in Florida. They're quite instrumental there, and in some ways, Walker is just trying to pay them back for their support.
So let's get to this piece that you've written, because I think it's extremely important. We see article after article, poll after poll. Workers want to join unions. Unions are what created the middle class in the 50s, 60s, and the 70s, and what we're seeing, the lack of unions right now, shrinking that middle class. What I'm seeing across the country, going after workers' rights to organize, even though I think the majority of people want it.
Yeah. No, I'd absolutely agree. When I wrote this article, what I wanted to do was present a common sense argument as to why right to work laws were actually anti-union laws, quote unquote right to work laws, and that you actually need union security agreements in order to support unions and therefore to support the middle class. And the basic argument is just who could run a business where anybody could come and take services from that business, but nobody had to pay. And that's basically what right-to-work laws do to unions. Unions are required under federal law to fairly and competently represent all the employees in their bargaining unit. And that's something that we accept as Americans, that if they're going to represent those employees, they have to represent them all. They have to represent them all fairly and competently. And they might even have to hire a lawyer to represent those people in certain cases. And if they, since they can't require, also federal law prevents unions or employers from requiring anybody to join a union. And if they can't require membership, the question is how do they get paid for those representation services? And what federal law currently allows is for unions to negotiate with their employers union security agreements, which says that as a condition of employment, employees, they don't have to join a union, but they have to at least pay for the union representation services that they receive. They have to pay an agency fee. And that's all that union security clauses do, is they say that you have to support the union at least to the extent that you pay for the services that are provided for you in your bargaining unit. And when state legislatures pass these quote-unquote right-to-work laws, what they're doing is they're taking away unions' ability to represent employees, or at least their ability to get paid for it, which, of course, in the long run is going to take away that ability to represent employees. And it's intended to do that. I mean, it's intended, just the right-to-work laws are intended to undermine union representation.
Right.
And then that brings us to the point that you started with, which is unions. The reason why this is so important is unions are essential for a healthy middle class in this country, both economically and politically. And we see that playing out in the political debate that's occurring in Wisconsin and across the country now. Without organization in the middle class, the right wing, the Koch brothers, will control the political debate. They'll control the legislature. They'll control the Congress, and they'll control the economy. And if we don't have unions to stand up for workers, they're not going to increase in their wages and benefits, and they're not going to have adequate say in the political system. So it's a power grab by the right. It's a power grab by the upper class.
Yeah, I've been saying that this is very Machiavellian. This is them gutting their opponents in public, one, but two, it's the wealth class dividing and conquering. They've done a nice job of slicing and dicing us and dividing working people, keeping them at each other's throats. But again, you know, it's this, to use the Jay Gould quote, I could easily pay half the working class to kill the other half. It's basically that. I mean, it's...
The fact that you bring up that quote, when I know I have studied a little bit of labor history, mostly from my labor books, And you have to go back to the 1890s. You have to go back to Jay Gould to find a power grab like this. But it is very similar. When we went through industrialization, they tried to do in all the guilds, and they took away power from the middle class by doing away with the guild system of labor unions. And it wasn't until when we went through the 1890s and the 1910s and teens, with very little representation in this country, and the upper class basically just run the country, and finally we ended up in the Great Depression. And at that point, that's when industrial organizations started, and we got industrial unions. And now they're trying to take that away. So your quotation is quite apt.
And it's what I've been saying for the longest time. And what they're working at doing is creating a desperation class to where we're going to go back to that era of the 1880s, 1890s, where there are two classes of people. There are the handful of robber barons, and then there are the rest of us basically scrumming for craps.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing. And China's the model for that, actually. I get to teach in China periodically, and there certainly is an in crowd that tends to run the country, and there's an underclass that scrabbles for wages and sometimes gets paid and sometimes doesn't get paid, you know?
Yeah, so when you look at this, and you brought up a second ago that people don't have to join unions, they don't have to be a member of the union. What you hear the right doing, and this is by design, it's basically scaring people into this Hollywood vision of labor. I was a Teamster for 21 years. Everyone basically goes, "Where's your baseball bat?" Because Hollywood has made this image of a union thug, and I'm the furthest thing from that.
Yeah. No, I know. I represented Teamsters when I was in practice, Rick. I represented a lot of different unions, but when I worked at Previon Goldberg and Allman in Milwaukee, actually the Michigan Teamsters and the Illinois Teamsters were some of my best clients. And I used to represent the bakery truck drivers in Detroit. And these were just ordinary working Joes, enjoyed a Tigers game. Have you over for brats and beer. They used to laugh about the image of the big bad Teamsters, and with good reason. I mean, they were just regular, ordinary working guys,
So how do we change this frame? Because as you've pointed out in this article, right to work laws are just the worst thing that could happen to working people in any state, because really there is no requirement that you have to join the union. Your ideology or your faith or whatever, if you don't want to, you don't have to. You can be a Beck objector if you want to. How do we change this frame that the right has thrown out there that, that unions equal tyranny? How do we change that?
That's a great question. And I mean, you're right that there are sometimes legitimate religious objections for not joining. But there's really no legitimate objection for not paying for the services that you receive. And, it's hard enough to organize a union under our current laws. The employers can resist. The employers can try to intimidate employees. And then if you add on to this that if you actually organize a union, that people don't actually have to pay to support the activities that the union engages in, that it just makes union organization so hard. And I guess this has been a debate inside the labor movement. The traditional AFL-CIO has said we need to lobby Congress, we need to lobby the state legislatures, we need to change the law, and that will help us organize, whereas the Change to Win people have argued, no, what we need to do is organize, and if we get more people organized on the grassroots, then we can affect legislation later. So it's a chicken and egg, but I suppose, the safe thing to do is to try to do both things. You have to organize on the ground level, which I've heard you talk about before, and then you also have to be willing to speak out to your legislators and your congressmen. I hope that the recent, debates in Congress and the recent debates in Wisconsin and Ohio and Pennsylvania have moved people to think, I can't just let the Tea Partiers control this whole debate. I have to become actively involved in the debate too, because they will. Legislators will listen if enough voters get upset.
Yeah, because they want to keep their job. But at the end of this, what I've been saying has to happen is people have to get in the streets. There's part of me that thinks that we shouldn't be lobbying legislators at all in labor. We should be organizing members and everything that there's an argument against the minimum wage. There's an argument against on-the-job safety. All that stuff should be done by workers on the job site. The people closest to the problem should be solving it, and that's why you band together. There is a school of thought along that lines, and there's part of me that buys that.
Well, I'll tell you, that's one of the best arguments for collective bargaining, and you see that already is that people who are actually involved in the workplace and who actually have to live with the conditions are the ones that get to determine what the conditions are. That is a great argument for collective bargaining. And you see that in the Indiana legislation, where they just took away collective bargaining rights from teachers. And what they've done is they've said they can only bargain over wages. They can't bargain over any other working conditions. And they're going to impose a state system of evaluating teachers based on test scores, student test scores. So we've gone from the school boards and the teachers who are actually involved in the schools and actually know something about educating kids and know what's going on. And instead, we're going to have some Republican bureaucrat or Republican state legislature determining how these teachers are going to be evaluated and how they're going to be compensated. And they don't know anything about it. So you're absolutely right that one of the best arguments for collective bargaining is that the people who are actually involved in doing the process or producing the good or producing the service, they're the ones that determine, you know, how things are done and what the working conditions are. It's a great argument. And
well,
it's an American argument for collective bargaining.
Absolutely. But here's what surprises me, and I'm surprised we're not seeing people clamoring to labor because, I mean, you look at this report that came out, I think it was last week, an analyst from J.P. Morgan Chase. He reported that profits of the S&P 500 are the highest they've been since the 60s, and his conclusion on why they're so high is because they were able to steal back wage gain and benefit gains from the last 20 years.
Oh, yeah.
So you look at this, and you people are being robbed every day on the job. Why aren't we clamoring to come together and stand up against this, I wonder?
I hope it's starting to take root. I mean, I'm hopeful for the next elections. I thought the election of President Obama and the Democrats in 2008 was hopeful, and then, of course, we had the setback in 2010. It's going to be decided that, you know, the grudge match is in 2012, and people need to make sure they get out and vote and get the right legislators and the right congressmen elected, because it is important, and it has been decades now. I mean, it's come to a head now. The recession has brought it to a head, but middle class wages have been stagnant for, you know, for at least three decades now, and the point that you make about right now, companies are swimming in profits, they're swimming in cash, they could be making investments, they could be expanding production, but they're not. And the ones that are really paying the price for it are working class people.
And what it's going to take is people in the street. It's going to take professors writing pieces in their local newspapers and getting them published across the state, as you have done, and I congratulate you for that. And it's going to take all of us working together. Kenneth Dow Schmidt, I appreciate your time. Love to have you back again real soon.
Thanks, Rick. And if you keep encouraging me, I'm going to keep writing them. So.
Please do. Please do.
All right.
We need strong, intelligent, articulate voices out there. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. Fellow working class heroes, I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Score another bold-faced demerit for the corporate lickspittles in Congress. This time, they delivered a slap to workers while simultaneously delivering their corporate overseers a cash bonanza. At issue was legislation to fund the Federal Aviation Administration. At the behest of airline lobbyists, Republican House leaders stopped the normal funding process by insisting on stripping airline workers of their right to form unions.
This asinine game playing meant that, on June 24th, America's essential airline safety agency began a shutdown that threatens about 36,000 workers, including safety inspectors, with layoffs. Another proud moment for airline greedheads and Republican boneheads. But, claimed the boneheads, consumers would benefit, because the shutdown meant that FAA had to stop collecting the 7.5% tax on airline tickets, thus saving flyers up to $50 per round trip. Ha! Huh, fat chance of consumers ever catching a break from this gang. Sure enough, the week before the shutdown, airline honchos quietly began raising ticket prices by, you guessed it, 7.5% or more. So, the $50 per ticket that is supposed to help maintain and improve our nation's air travel infrastructure, instead, is siphoned straight into the bank accounts of American Airlines, Delta, Frontier, JetBlue, Southwest, and U.S. Air. Their ripoff adds up to some $30 million a day. This is Jim Hightower saying, perhaps you assume that this ripoff will stop once the FAA is back in action. Ha, again. Airline CEOs are nimble-fingered pickpockets who keep inventing new schemes for lifting money from workers and customers alike. They have no intention of rolling back this corporate tax. To help fight these greedheads, contact Transportation Workers Union, TWU.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Yes, welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So it was late in the month of June that the Herman Cain train steamrolled its way into Greenville, South Carolina. He wanted to share his economic vision. He wanted to share the Jobs for America plan. He was heading to the next innovation center there in Greenville to lay out his economic guiding principles, three of them. Production drives the economy, risk-taking drives growth, and measurements must be dependable. That was it. He was right on. That's his vision for economic growth. Production drives the economy. So I thought it was strange when ABC's Arlette Sinez asked the former Pizza King about his T-shirts, which evidently were made in Honduras. She says, this is one of your T-shirts. If you look at the label, it says it's made in Honduras. Are you aware of that? And here was the Herman Cain train's response.
No, I wasn't aware that it was made in Honduras. I just was aware that it was Fruit of the Loom, which is an American company. So where they buy their T-shirts, you know, nope, we did not look at that.
It's an American company. We don't care where they make their product, just as long as it's got an American name on it. We don't care that they made it overseas. We don't care they made it with sweatshop labor. We don't care if they made it with 10-year-old children. We don't care. All it says is there's a building in the U.S. that says American made. He goes on to say this.
What I would do, you know what I would do? I'd find out how many employees does Fruit of the Loom employ right here in the United States of America. And so when people try to draw a comparison between some of the things that we buy, also look at how many people are employed. It's the same thing with cars, okay? A lot of the parts are made in the United States. And what about those salesmen and those salespeople that made a living selling products? So the fact that it was made in Honduras, I don't have a political statement with respect to that.
Here's the thing, Herman. Let me educate you. It's odd that I've got to educate a CEO on what it's like to be an American. It's odd that I've got to talk to a presidential candidate like a child, because evidently he doesn't get the basic concept. The people who were selling those products, whether it's underwear or cars, they were going to be selling underwear or cars, whether it was made here or on the moon. So your argument that, well, we have to worry about the jobs that are here because of that. No, those products would have been made here, would have created more jobs. And we wouldn't have the 14 million people unemployed. We wouldn't have 9.2% unemployment. We wouldn't have massive debt. We wouldn't have huge deficits. We might actually have money in our coffers to do the things we need to do, invest in infrastructure, education, healthcare, all the things that, you know, a first world country should be doing that we don't seem to be doing very well. So when I hear the Herman Cain train saying, well, you know, I don't really care where it's made, you know, that's not the worry. The worry, not at all. She said, and again, she asked the follow-up question, would you consider changing your campaign gear to an American company? Would you consider having that work done here? Herman responded,
well, it depends on the reason why somebody would want me to change it. Changing it because someone says it's made outside the United States alone isn't a reason. So if I have a compelling reason, yes. But if I don't have a compelling reason, no.
So he doesn't really care where it's made, and he's not going to change his mind, even if you care. He goes on to say that he finishes up by saying this.
You want to know why? We live in a global marketplace, and we are not going to reignite the growth in this country with any sort of protectionism. No. The best way to reignite growth in this country is to turn America into the most business-friendly nation on the planet, and that's what I plan to do.
Gotta turn it into the most business-friendly planet on the nation, on the company on the planet. Good stuff. Gonna take those union members up, throw them out of planes. Business-friendly. And I gotta tell you, you know, it's frustrating on a number of levels that this is a presidential candidate, two of them now. You've got Newt Gingrich, El Salvador, and now the Herman Cain train there in Honduras. Let's go to the phone lines. Got Brandon on line one. How you doing tonight, Brandon?
Doing pretty good.
What's on your mind?
Hey there. I'm actually, as far as I told your call screener of Ron Paul, who had a similar question, as his campaign shirts were made in El Salvador, and I think he fielded the question pretty well in saying that the cost of the T-shirts to be made in America, as you're saying, you want these jobs to be in America. The problem is, how much is it going to cost to pay an American worker to do that same job, and how much is that going to increase the price of said T-shirt? Because I'm not going to pay $25 for a campaign T-shirt.
Well, the Herman Cain T-shirt
when
is $30.
They can get them for...
Hold on, the Herman Cain T-shirt's $30.
Because that goes to his campaign.
Okay, well, can I ask you a quick question?
Yeah.
What do you do for a living?
I'm actually a district executive with a not-for-profit organization.
Could we do that overseas cheaper than what you make it for?
Then what we get it for?
Can I have your job done overseas cheaper than what you're
going
to do for?
Absolutely not, because I work with volunteers organizing them here. That's completely irrelevant because I don't produce a product. I produce a service directly to people.
As I'm seeing it, and again, you brought up an interesting point. The question then becomes, what kind of a country do we want to have? Do we want to have a country where we produce nothing and we end up in debt? Let me ask you a quick question.
That's what we're going towards.
It's because you're taking a position that since I can buy a T-shirt in El Salvador for pennies, we should do that. This disconnect between what we're doing and what we should be doing is just driving me insane. If you're talking, there are companies in this state who produce T-shirts, who could do it competitively when you add into the shipping costs, who can do it competitively and with better quality. Yet because, hey, we can save a penny here.
If that was true, they would do it. If that was true, they would. But telling you, if he can get those campaign T-shirts here after shipping and everything for $5 and then get a $25 return on that as an investment into his campaign, as a campaign donation, that's going to support him a lot more than buying a T-shirt for $10 after shipping and production here and only getting a $20 contribution to the campaign.
And you think that's a good thing?
Do you not think that's a good thing?
No, I actually don't. I actually think that we should be producing products in this country for sale here. If we're going to continue this race to the bottom mentality, most jobs can be outsourced.
Well, what do you want to see happen? Do you want to see people be educated and work in service-type jobs, or do you want to see everybody working in those bottom run-of-the-mill jobs. I mean, I have nothing
you cannot have
bottom for run-of-the-mill jobs
okay,
because
but
my father works in a factory himself. I've worked in a factory myself, and it's not the kind of job that we're moving towards now. I'm 23 years old, and people of my generation who are graduating at very high rates from colleges, we're going into college. It's the norm now to go into the service sector.
Yeah, and what's the unemployment rate amongst your generation?
What's
the unemployment rate of your generation?
The unemployment rate is enormous.
With college education? With a college education?
With a college education, yes.
And, again, we go back to this idea that the millions of jobs that we've given away in manufacturing because of our trade policies that benefit a handful, that you're encouraging, that's the reason your unemployment rate's so high.
The unemployment rate is that high because there aren't those kinds of – there isn't the kind of demand yet for us to be a completely service-based economy. Yet.
Is that your vision for the country? You want to be a service-based economy?
Yeah.
Do you think we can survive? Wow. I got to tell you.
That we can survive by exporting our hard blue-collar jobs
wow.
and transforming our society.
Do you know anything about World War II, my friend? Do you know anything about World War II? Wow. You scare me. You scare me, son. Scare me. I appreciate the call. I got to take a break here, though. You scare me. Wow. That is just... We don't need to manufacture. We don't need to produce anything. We just need to wipe people's noses and you know, be nonprofit volunteers. And wow. That scares the hell out of me. Right back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
The following message is brought to you by SEIU Local 668.
My name is Lewis. I help senior citizens get the services they need. I work for you, the taxpayers, in the Area Agency on Aging. Our senior population is growing. Their incomes are shrinking. Their need for government services is increasing, all at the same time. Funding for these services is not keeping pace, which means long waiting lists, huge caseloads, and more seniors at risk. We all know that these are tough economic times, but who wants to see our senior citizens suffer? They did their part. They worked hard and paid their taxes. Now it's our turn to make sure they get the services they need. Please contact your state legislators today and demand that they respect our senior citizens and vote to increase funding for programs that protect them.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated, professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all.
It's class warfare. My class is winning, but they shouldn't be.
A working class hero is something to be.
The taxation system has tilted toward the rich and away from the middle class.
Working class hero is something to be.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. You know, I guess the class war is wearing down the wealth class. Evidently, they're tired of the president pointing out the fact that they've never had it so good, pointing out the fact that their coffers have never been fuller and their tax rates have never been lower. They're kind of tired and kind of angry about that, I think, and which is why you're seeing so much money being put into these front groups who are pushing this really radical right-wing agenda. And I got to be honest, you know, with the guy that just called in, Brandon, if call back when we've got more time. We really need to talk. Mind-blowing. Anyway, I've got Michael Winship on the phone. He's the president of the Writers Guild of America East. He's also a senior writer, writing fellow at Demos. Michael, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, I'm delighted to talk with you, Rick. I'm actually just back from Washington myself. So.
Yeah, I look at this piece that you've written, When the Super Rich Cry Class Warfare. Again, you know, you look at times have never been better. Corporate profits are through the roof. Companies are more profitable than they've been since the 60s, primarily because they've been stealing wages from workers. And yet, that's not enough.
Yeah, and you know, they've been hiding their profits overseas and taking all these tax breaks, and it's just outrageous. And the thing that really struck me, that really sort of inspired this piece, was a short piece I'd seen in Politico about a meeting that was held a couple of weeks ago at Ken Langone, who's one of the co-founders of Home Depot. He and a bunch of his very rich friends were trying to persuade Chris Christie to run for president, and they were complaining and saying that about class warfare and that they hadn't done anything to deserve such attacks and that Obama hadn't been fair to them somebody mentioned Huey Long populism, which as I said in the article, accusing Obama of Huey Long populism is like, you know, comparing me to Huey Newton. I mean, it's crazy.
It is crazy, but what's going on and what scares me? We just had a call a second ago where, you know, this kid's telling me that we don't need manufacturing. We can do everything with the service economy. And just no way a nation can exist that produces nothing but I'll wash your car if you'll cut my grass.
No, absolutely. I mean, we have to reestablish the manufacturing base in this country. And I was just in D.C. with people from the AFL-CIO. I was just down there with Leo Girard from the Steelworkers and a bunch of other fine folks, and this is exactly their argument that they're making.
You know, but there's this frame out there, you know, and it's been since Reagan. I mean, we are living the Reagan dream.
I know. And the crazy thing about it in terms of manufacturing, I mean, as Leo said, today we can make a ton of steel cheaper than the Chinese can. So why are we doing this?
Well, again, you know, I think the steelworkers have been the ones on the forefront of fighting these trade cases.
Absolutely.
When the companies don't want it, because they can make things cheaper overseas,
mm-hmm.
And really not even cheaper anymore,
no.
But with less labor input and really being able to pollute a whole heck of a lot more.
And you've got this overall sort of, I mean, philosophy of the free market economy, which has sort of become like, cargo cult. In terms of people worshiping this idea, which is just patently false. I mean, a free market is great, but, you know, it needs some restraints and it needs some revenue-bearing income for the government, and it's nuts.
Yeah, I look at this debt debate we just had, and you know, this hostage situation is what it really was.
Yeah.
And, you know, you look at the fact that at the end of the day, the people who are going to be paying the freight are those who are least able to do it.
Right.
Folks who are least able to shoulder this burden are going to be the ones who are going to be saddled with it. And both parties seem to be okay with that.
I know. I was getting off the train in Washington on Sunday, and there were a lot of flags at mass, and I never found out the real reason, but we were saying maybe it's the death of the New Deal.
And, you know, the sad reality is that the right has done such a masterful job, and you have to give them credit at co-opting the media structure in this country that is okay with some people.
I know, and they've just been pumping money into these campaigns, and we're seeing it now in Wisconsin. I mean, I'm very hopeful that the recall elections will be successful next week, but you're seeing Karl Rove and you're seeing all these various groups are starting to pump millions and millions of dollars into those campaigns. And it's going to be closer than I'm afraid we're prepared for.
Right. Let me ask you this, Michael Winship. You know, as we go down the road, how do you go back and undo the damage that's been done by 40 years of pro-business policy, of pro-business messaging? I'm still struck with the kid that called just a minute ago, mm-hmm. said we don't need manufacturing.
Incredible.
I mean, I just... And the sad thing is I know people like that who think, well, we don't need that anymore. We're smarter people. We're going to be able to wipe each other's noses and cut each other's grass.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we just have to, you know, it's the old tried and true. I mean, we have to get up on our hind legs and fight back. We have to organize. We have to get out there and campaign. We have to vote. That's a big deal. We have to make sure that we vote. We have to be fighting not only against the various things we've been seeing in this debt ceiling fight, but things like what's been going on in the whole voter ID fight with all these different states trying to pass voter suppression laws to keep the very people who need all these things from being able to go to the polls.
And to me, that's a crime. I mean, the fact that you don't vote in this country is a crime, but to go out and actively, as Scott Walker has done, and as some of the legislation and some of the thoughts here are going to do, closing down places where people will be able to get these voter IDs, and I'm sure they're going to be in interesting areas to make sure to maximize the disenfranchisement rate.
We're the only democracy in the entire world where a single political party, a major political party, is actively trying to keep people from voting. Stunning.
But again, you know, it goes back to what my government teacher in high school said back, you know, years and years ago. Don't bother voting. It makes my vote that much stronger.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was being facetious,
right.
But the reality is, you know, the right knows that if the population comes out, they're going to lose.
Or as my old great aunt in Texas used to say, I never voted, only encourages them.
That's a good one. But, you know, the reality here is I think what has to happen is we have to collapse as a nation. We have to feel massive pain. And I thought that was going to happen after 2008 because so many people have already forgotten what September of 2008 looked like.
Well, yeah, except now I think, you know, I think sadly we may get what you're talking about because we're heading right back into a double-dip recession. I mean, when you see economic growth at only 1.3% in the first quarter, I mean, that's hardly statistically imaginable. That's stagnation right there. And it really, I think, pretty much guarantees a double-dip recession, especially with these spending cuts that they're going to be putting in place due to this debt deal.
And you go back to history and you look at 1936 to 1937, when the conservatives of that era, you know, kind of conned FDR into doing the exact same thing.
Exactly right.
You know, while we've got this recovery that's, you know, maybe happening, you're now going to suck a bunch of resource out of it? It makes no sense.
No, it makes no sense to me either.
And especially when you look at the Congress went on vacation, 5 weeks on vacation, while allowing 4,000 FAA employees to sit out on the street, and probably anywhere between 90,000 and 200,000 construction workers.
At least.
What does that say?
Not to mention the $200 million a week in lost revenue from the sales taxes on airplane tickets.
Which is going to the coffers of the airline industry.
I mean, Delta did say yesterday they were going to refund people that money, but we'll see it. I'll believe it when I see it.
I mean, it's interesting that Delta says that when they're the cause of this whole
thing. Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, at the end of this, I mean, when, you know, and maybe you've got a better sense of this through your organization, you know, when are we going to realize that we're being shafted here? You know, I mean, you're the Writers Guild. You guys are the ones who are putting out content. Most of the content I'm seeing in the mainstream corporate-controlled media is very pro-business. You know, we need more policies and deregulation, more of the same stuff that got us into this mess that we're in.
Yeah, well, we just have to keep speaking up, and I think programs like yours here and you know, I've worked with Bill Moyers over the years, and we've tried to make those statements on Bill's shows and to talk about these things. And even though we're off the air right now, I think you won't be surprised if we come back on the air pretty soon because these things are important to talk about. We just have to keep standing up and making our voices heard.
You know, I just talked to a professor from Indiana University, Professor Dov Schmidt, and he's saying, look, you know, there's this attack on workers' rights. There's an attack on collective bargaining. There's an attack on the mechanism that created the largest middle class in history. And to be honest, it seems like we're on the ropes.
Yeah, and I think there are other aspects of it, too, that aren't being examined closely enough. And one of those things is the attacks on education, the attacks on public education in this country, not just teachers, but you have a lot of these people from the writer who are saying, you know, public education is socialist and we shouldn't really have that. And they're basically trying to dumb us down so they can keep their control.
And privatize it where they can profit.
Yes, exactly. And allow only the very rich to get a decent education.
And that's what we're going to be seeing here in Pennsylvania in the next several weeks. In fact, today there was a hearing on doing just that, privatizing education,
mm-hmm.
With these golden lottery tickets, these vouchers
exactly.
that they want to hand out that they think are the answer to our system instead of doing mm-hmm. the hard work.
Yeah.
You know, I remember back in the 70s when I was a kid, they tried busing.
Mm-hmm.
Probably
sure.
you remember it.
Sure.
You know, they were busing kids from one side of the poor side of Cleveland on the west side to the poor side of Cleveland on the east side.
Mm-hmm.
Poor kids going to poor neighborhoods back and forth,
right.
wasting tons of resource that could have been used to make the schools better. But again, they thought that was the answer.
Mm-hmm.
I think vouchers are the same thing.
Yeah,
they don't
agree.
Know what else to do. And hey, let's give this a try. Who knows?
I agree with you totally.
It's absolutely nuts. Mm-hmm. I did want to congratulate you guys on the organizing victory at the Onion.
Well, we're very happy about that. We're very excited about that. We have organized the writers at Onion News Network, which is a television series that runs on the Independent Film Channel on IFC. And that's a great victory for us. You know, we've been very successful organizing people in late night comedy here in the East. We represent the writers at Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert and David Letterman and Jimmy Fallon and Saturday Night Live, and now we're adding the people at Onion, which we're really excited about.
Yeah, I love the work that the Onion people do there, and it's now it's even better.
Yeah, exactly. And I keep saying, you know, I said to the management people, you know, you can't sit there and go out and make fun of all the people and then just act just like them, you know.
Excellent point. Michael Winship, I appreciate the time and the article. Of course, when the super rich call class warfare, we got a link at our site at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Michael Winship's name.
Great.
It'll take
thanks,
you right
Rick.
There. Michael, thanks so much.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure to talk with you.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Covering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888. Hey there, fellow working-class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Don't really care about the economy. Don't care much about democracy. I'm a member of the GOP, trying to form a plutocracy. But if I can just bamboozle you, and you'll share my narrow point of view, what a wonderful world this would be.
Well, that'd be one where nobody has a job. Where I guess the economy would then be, let me cut your grass and you can wash my car, or I guess I'll paint your house and you can shovel my driveway. That's the economy that some seem to think is our future. Look, if we don't have an economy where we're chopping down trees, creating 2x4s, turning those 2x4s and that wood into furniture and selling that furniture, adding value every step of the way, it scares me when you have people who understand so little about the economy. So, well, we can do everything by washing each other's cars and washing each other's dogs and cutting each other's grass and, you know, making each other dinner. We can have an economy like that. You cannot. And again, I guess part of it goes back to my, you know, I took economics years and years ago, the whole rice and beans argument. Maybe we think we're farmers. But even then, that's production. You're producing something. You're adding value to those seeds, and you've actually got something that you've added value to. I'm sorry. I don't get this whole service-based economy thing. I understand Reagan wanted to get us away from being an industrial nation because the profiteers wanted to exploit cheap labor, exploit easy regulations on the environment so you can pollute and profit. I get that. But when you've got people in this country, working people in this country saying, well, we can do it. Yeah, we can cook each other dinner. We can cut each other's grass. Yeah, that's the way we want to go. That's scary. And if you go back to World War II, and if I had time, I would have schooled it a little bit. The whole reason that we were victorious during that conflict was because we outproduced. We were able to make steel. We were able to turn that steel into tanks and guns and planes and all of the stuff that you need to have a war. And if we're going to be a war society, which we seem to want to be, considering we're in about 140 nations around the world, you need to be able to produce something. And this just, my head's about to explode, literally.
He's perplexing on several levels. First of all, I understand he's supporter of Congressman Paul, president. Congressman Paul is opposed to the free trade agreements, adamantly, first point. Second point is, I don't think that the young gentleman understands that we have pretty much gone away from a manufacturing and an industrial-based economy to a service-based economy. Now, there's some left, but we have decimated it pretty darn good in the last 10 years. We can, and here's the bottom line. Young people like this maybe don't quite understand, but I think too many Americans have given up and think that, well, we'll never get back to that. Well, you know what? We can reestablish our industrial manufacturing base if it is a priority. Well, there's enough wealth. Well, there's enough wealth in this country to do it, Rick. I'm not saying we're ever going to go back to the way we were, World War II or post-World War II, 60s and even into the 70s. However, we can definitely reestablish to a larger degree than what we have a manufacturing and industrial base. And that takes commitment and it takes money, but it takes a little bit of time. Well, we can do it if we have the will as a country.
Yeah, but here's the thing, and you look at this, and you know, forgive him, he's a young guy. He's been told his entire life that we're going to be going down this service-based path, that this is the answer, and told that education is going to be the key. And that has calculated in the heads of many as you have to have a college education. To me, an education is not just about a college degree. I have a college degree. I'm never going to use it. Drove a truck for years. Made a much better living driving a truck than I would have doing something else. There are trades that people get education from. There are vocations that people get education from. It's not, you know, this whole talk of education isn't textbook. And we still need people who can do things with their hands. We need doers. We need tinkerers. And the problem is we're losing that brain power. We're losing that ability to innovate. You know, a lot of the things that the inventions that came about in the 50s, 60s, 70s, even in the 80s, were because people were tinkering with things. They worked on an assembly line, and maybe that assembly line had a machine that someone thought a better way of using it because that's what they were doing. You know, and someone told me the other day, you know, the machines that put the little chips into your iPhones, that machine was dreamt up out of a stitching machine. Where the needle would come down That's the where they came up with it. We're losing that. That kind of, that stuff is going to China. And if you're not scared of losing a manufacturing capability in this country, I think we're in much bigger problems, much deeper water than even I imagined before. Because I think manufacturing is one of those bipartisan issues where everyone gives it at least enough lip service. This is, you know, really distressing.
Well, even common sense things, and you talked about it, and we were outraged, you know, wind power. You would think, now there's a technology that's expanding. We're using greater and greater use of it, solar power. And what do we find? The Chinese have cornered the market pretty much on making those wind turbines. We're even losing that battle. Why? Because we've allowed corporate America to gain almost complete control of the process, and the laws are slanted to allow them to invest overseas.
Well, and if you think about it, you know, the manufacturing that happens overseas, the workers in those countries pay taxes, and this is where the whole trade, where I've been making the argument on our trade deficits. If we had balanced trade, where people were buying equally, and, you know, we were last trade surplus, 1975, if we had that trade parity, if we were, you know, just even, we wouldn't have the deficits we have. We wouldn't be in debt, because those workers would be creating product for sale that they'd be paying taxes on their wages, and the whole snowballing effect upward, you know, the whole spiraling up of the economy. And what's really, really distressing, and I can't express it enough, is that there is someone who thinks we can exist as a nation pushing papers. We can exist as a nation doing service, cleaning hotel rooms and sweeping the streets. Evidently, that's what's scary. And I guess maybe it is the whole Reagan years forward. I guess it is all of the talk that we've been doing on education, because, you know, in order to get ahead in this world, you gotta have a good education. And that's because we've lost the steel mills. That's because we've lost the auto plants. That's because we've lost a good bit of the solid middle class manufacturing. And what we've done, we've taken those wage gains. And the guy at J.P. Morgan Chase laid this out. They're more profitable than they've been since the 60s because they've been able to steal back those wage gains. They've been able to produce overseas cheaper, and then without any recourse whatsoever, bring that stuff back here. Yet, if we want to do that, not happening. Why do you think these trade agreements have trade adjustment assistance? Why do you think they want that? They know we're going to lose more jobs. You know, look at the Mexican truck scenario, where we're opening up the southern border to Mexican domiciled trucks to come here into the U.S. There has not been one discussion about what happens when American drivers go into Mexico. None. So when I asked the kid about, you know, could we outsource your job, I'll bet you we could. And if we can't outsource the job, I'll bet you we could bring somebody in on an HB1 visa to do it for half the price. I mean, if we really want to get down to the core, which is we want to drive wages down so low that the corporations and the top entities profit so much, then let's go that route. If we can outsource talk show hosts. In fact, we can probably computerize this.
Well, he's buying into this. Well, you know what? If I get an education and I really go out and I educate myself, I'm okay for the future. Well, here's the problem. Look what happened to steel mills. Steel mills went down. They got decimated late 70s, early 80s. A lot of them around this area, so I know a little bit of what I'm talking about. And they were told, well, you know what? You got to go to school. Someone went to school and became computer techs, made good money, 90, 95, 100,000. All of a sudden, they figured out, well, you know, we can outsource. We can take these jobs to Pakistan and India.
Malaysia.
And originally, it was, well, it doesn't matter the country. The point is, they're paying those people maybe $15,000 a year. The point is, education alone, depending on what your education is not the answer. Because we're outsourcing those jobs that you thought you were being trained for.
And you can't even follow them over there. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. When we come back, we're going to talk about the child labor law that they're ramming through. We're going to talk with Norma Flores Lopez about that back after this.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much
French octave, but I do know that I need you. And if you fall for all the crap I spew, what a wonderful world this would be.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. $200 million per week. That's how much money the shutdown of the Federal Aviation Administration is costing the federal government. Not only is it increasing the federal deficit, which Republicans have fought so hard to reduce in the debt ceiling fight, it also leaves 4,000 workers furloughed and is having ripple effects on nearly 90,000 related contract jobs. The FAA has been shut down over new rules that could make it easier for workers to form unions. But Association of Flight Attendants President Vita Shook says that isn't the reason her union wants the FAA back on the job.
This is not about stacking the deck for unions. It's about basic democratic principles of fair elections. The bottom line is that real people are getting hurt because of Republican political gains.
During a conference call, Shook listed a number of projects that are stalled due to the shutdown, such as installing a seismic sensor at an airport in Anchorage and efforts to modernize control towers throughout the country.
$2.5 billion. That's the total scale of airport construction projects on hold due to the FAA shutdown throughout the nation.
70,000 to 90,000 additional workers are being impacted by the shutdown of the FAA's construction projects. In addition, failure to pass the larger reauthorization bill is impeding job creation.
280,000. That's the number of jobs that would be created by passing a multi-year FAA reauthorization bill. And the last number, 20. 20 is the number of times a clean extension for funding the FAA has been passed while we continue to debate the larger reauthorization bill.
We Are Ohio's campaign to repeal the gutting of public worker collective bargaining is maintaining the high energy and huge volume of huge number of volunteers that gathered more petition signatures than any other effort in Ohio history, Doug Cunningham reports.
Twice as many signatures as needed have been validated, and the repeal of SB 5, the Republican bill attacking public worker collective bargaining, will be on Ohio's November ballot. Melissa Fizikas of We Are Ohio says the group's focus now is maintaining the momentum, the energy, and the 10,000-plus volunteers working on this campaign to defend collective bargaining rights.
We woke up on June 30th, the day after we delivered those signatures, in the second phase of our campaign, ready to go. We have more than 10,000 volunteers who were on the ground collecting signatures, and all of those people are saying to us, what's next? How can I remain involved? How can I keep helping? And what are we going to do to make sure that we repeal this bill in November?
Fizikas says this SB 5 repeal effort clearly demonstrates that Ohio's people are against radical moves to destroy labor rights.
Extreme politicians went too far with this bill, and they want an opportunity to repeal it in November.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
So tomorrow, I guess the hearing is going to be, it's going to be 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., room 205. They're in the Capitol building here in Harrisburg. House Bill 927, the Delosier Bill, going to make a bunch of changes to the child labor law. And you look at what happened in Illinois. You had two girls, 14 years old, electrocuted on the job. On the job, 14 years old. You look at the kid I talked about last week, the 16-year-old kid out there picking bell peppers in California in 106-degree heat. He passed out, throwing up on the side of the, throwing up. They end up firing the whole family. Is this how we treat people? Is this how we treat, especially children? Just amazing stuff to me. That's why I've asked Norma Flores-Lopez, the director of the Children in the Fields campaign at the Association of Farm Worker Opportunity Programs, AFOP.org is their site, to come talk to us a bit about the work that they do. Norma, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi. Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
You know, I think It's been so long since we've had the conversation about children working in dangerous jobs. And as I pointed out, you know, just this past week, two 14-year-old girls killed, electrocuted in a you know, detasseling corn in Illinois. And these other stories, at some point, I think we have to have this conversation again as we're seeing legislation across this country wanting to gut the laws that we've had in place.
Absolutely. You know, right now, well, actually over the last years, the Department of Labor continuously puts agriculture as one of the most dangerous industries. It's right up there with mining and with construction. And luckily, we have, at the moment, child labor laws that don't allow for children to be in those particular industries to be able to work there. But unfortunately, right now, the child labor laws allow for kids to still continue to work in agriculture, despite the number of injuries that happen to these kids. So the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938, back in 1938, says that, you know, as a country, we decided we need to protect our children. We need to make sure that they get an education and that their health is priority. And so we set these child labor laws across the board. But unfortunately, we left this exemption for agriculture. And as we've been seeing in the news recently, these are the consequences. These kids are being exposed to very, very dangerous elements, to extreme heat, using sharp tools, going operating around, working outside around big machinery. And unfortunately, we have stories like these two young girls that ended up even dying out there.
And, you know, I understand why in 1938 they exempted farm, you know, people working on farms, because they were families. They had children. The children worked on the farms. I get that. I get the family farm thing. You need all hands on deck. But these two girls, the farm, as I understand it, maybe you have a better idea, owned by Monsanto, a huge multinational corporation, not a mom and pop group at all.
Absolutely. That seems, you know, when we hear and we talk to a lot of people about this, they seem to think that a lot of the food that we eat today still comes from those small little farms, the pictures that we see on, you know, the labels of our foods, when in reality the picture is very, very different than that. Very few farms are, a small percentage of the farms here in the U.S. are family-owned. The majority of them do belong to huge corporations where folks are just numbers. And so it's a lot more difficult to be able to ensure the safety of a child when it's one of your hundreds and thousands of employees that are out there, as opposed to being your own child, your own daughter and son. And so that was a perfect example, the Monsanto, you know, huge corporation as we know it. You have so many employees out there, it's hard to ensure the safety of every one of them. And so with kids, when we're talking about our children, I think it's important that we make sure that they're very well protected and not being exposed to dangerous elements. And so because of that, that's part of the work that we're doing with the Children in the Fields campaign, that we are trying to advocate so that these kids that are working out in our agriculture get to benefit from those same safeguards that we see in other industries, and would be able to have more protection, you know, because along with being exposed to these dangerous elements, they're also allowed to be able to work way more hours than anywhere else. Right now, the federal standards allow kids to be able to work in agriculture for more than, you know, an unlimited amount of hours, as long as it's not during the school day. And so we have kids that are working in agriculture out there doing things like detasseling corn, which may not seem that it might be that bad, but when we're talking about having to work 10 to 12-hour days, having to work 7 days a week, this can take a real big toll on the kids' health.
Yeah, and if you look at the story of the kid in California, 106 degrees on the day he showed up for work at 6 o'clock, and his family worked a 10-and-a-half-hour day that day. And because he passed out, they told the whole family, don't bother coming back. And again, you know, you look at our labor laws are so badly broken. And like I said, you know, I agreed, you know, the idea of the family farm needed those exemptions. Today, what we need is to do away with that and give people some protections and the minimum wage as well.
Absolutely. You know, these kids are out there in those fields, as we mentioned, working under those dangerous conditions, being exposed to pesticides, to that some of them that are known carcinogens, being exposed to dangerous environmental conditions, the hot weather conditions that we were talking about for long hours out there. and as I mentioned, the dangerous machinery and tools. And so these kids are risking their health, they're risking their childhood, they're even risking their education as, you know, as about, we estimate more than half of these kids don't graduate out of high school because of having the pressures that come with working out those fields. So you combine all of that, and these kids are risking all of this for very, very low wages. You know, again, farm workers don't enjoy the same protections and benefits that you and I get to make sure, you know we have in our workplace. And especially when we're talking about folks that have language barriers that are out in rural areas, we see a lot of instances of wage theft, and especially when it comes to children.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Norma Flores-Lopez, director of the Children in the Fields campaign at the Association of Farm Worker Opportunity Programs. AFOP.org is their website. There's a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Norma Flores-Lopez's name. It'll take you right there. And you brought up wage theft, which is one of those things that, you know, infuriates me. I mean, if you're going to do the work, you should be paid for it. But given the fact that a lot of the people who are doing these jobs have, you know, immigration status that may be questionable, these are folks who are easy to exploit.
Yes, and as you mentioned, the majority of farm workers are here illegally, but even those that are here legally, that are working with and have put in the time and the effort and have everything in order, they still get to feel a lot of those pressures. They get threatened with having their legal status taken away. Since they're out there in rural areas, a lot of the times they depend on the grower for housing. They depend on the grower for steady work. And a lot of the growers share a lot of the same farm workers. So as soon as you get one that's starting to start up trouble, a lot of the times the growers speak with each other, and then you're left with no work for the rest of the year. And because farm workers desperately need these wages to be able to feed their families, they end up being up against the wall and struggling to be able to make ends meet. So many times when they see a lot of these abuses, including wage theft, they just kind of keep it, you know, hush and don't really speak out against these kind of abuses that exist out there. And as I mentioned, especially when it comes to children, when you're threatening kids, also with their parents, it makes it really difficult for these kids to want to speak up, and that's because the majority of farm worker children, though, they are U.S. citizens, they are U.S. born, but because they still live in a lot of fear and they're very impressionable, they're open to these type of abuses happening.
You know, I read the story of this kid, Nicholas, and I brought it up a couple of times, a kid who was picking peppers in a 106-degree temperature, and the statements from the parents are what grabbed me by the throat. The fact that they watched their child throw a heaving on the side of the road, you know, passing out in distress, obviously, and they couldn't go to him. They couldn't take care of him. They couldn't help him because they were basically being told, if you do, you're fired. And ultimately they were fired anyway, but I can't imagine that kind of powerlessness, that kind of inability to defend my child.
You know, and that happens a lot more often, and it is a terrible feeling, a lot of those pressures that these farm workers feel every day, and even the children. I myself grew up out there working in those fields, and I remember having growers yelling at me in my face, cursing me out, and my mother standing right next to me, who didn't speak any English at all, asking me, what's going on? What is he saying to you? And I would just lie to my mother and say, it's nothing, Mom. Don't worry about it. It's fine. And just holding that pressure. And that's because I was, you know, uneducated. I was smart. I knew how to defend myself. But because I knew that my parents really desperately needed this work, that pressure that I felt, that I had to take this abuse day in and day out for a whole season, It's because you know the need that your family has, you know that you desperately need that money, and you end up having to just keep your mouth shut. And we see that even as farm workers are out there and they're being asked to go into fields that they know are sprayed with pesticides that are not ready for them to go in, but a lot of times they get threatened with that similar type of thing. And then you have the story of Carlitos, a little boy that was born without any arms, without any legs, because that same thing happened to that lady in North Carolina a few years back, where she was forced to go back into the field or risk losing her job, and her child ended up being born with those kind of defects. And so we do hear this, these kind of stories a lot, and which is why we believe that these kids should not be allowed to be out there. The same way we don't allow kids to be in offices. I mean, we don't allow a 12-year-old to be in an air-conditioned office making copies for us. But yet we're perfectly fine with the same 12-year-old to be out in those fields working in 106-degree weather 12 hours a day to be able to make sometimes less than minimum wage because they don't have that enforcement to make sure that they're getting paid a fair wage. And the same thing with 16-year-olds. In every other industry, it's illegal for a 16-year-old to be able to do hazardous work. Yet in agriculture, we allow them to be able to operate heavy machinery, to be able to be exposed and use dangerous chemicals, all of these things that are work that is reserved for adults in every other industry. And so I think those are changes that need to happen in our law. Agriculture is not this idea that we used to have, and we definitely need to be able to update these laws so that all kids are protected equally.
I'm right there with you. Got about a minute left. What do I do? What do we do to change this? What do we as a group, as a community, what's the ask?
The ask is a couple of things. First and foremost is to be able to become informed about where your food comes from. Many people think that just because your food is organic or local that means that there were no kids being used to be able to harvest those foods, and that's not true. I've been out to organic farms that have children out there working, and these consequences follow them as well. So we need to make sure that we're asking where our food is coming from. We're demanding that the food not be picked by children and that these laws get updated, whether it's on the state level or on the national level, as there is with the CARE Act, for example. We need to make sure that these kids are receiving the same protection so that 16-year-old little boys are not fainting in California, or even, as we know, that tragic story of those girls in Illinois that ended up passing and won't have a chance to be able to grow up. So we need to make sure that all of our kids, America's kids, are being protected equally.
Right there with you. Norma Flores-Lopez, I appreciate your time, Director of the Children in the Fields Campaign at the Association of Farm Worker Opportunity Programs, AFOP.org is the website. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
All right. We're going to take a quick break back after your calls. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
America. Rick Smith.
Score another bold-faced demerit for the corporate lickspittles in Congress. This time, they delivered a slap to workers while simultaneously delivering their corporate overseers a cash bonanza. At issue was legislation to fund the Federal Aviation Administration. At the behest of airline lobbyists, Republican House leaders stopped the normal funding process by insisting on stripping airline workers of their right to form unions. This asinine game-playing meant that, on June 24th, America's essential airline safety agency began a shutdown that threatens about 36,000 workers, including safety inspectors, with layoffs. Another proud moment for airline greedheads and Republican boneheads. But, claimed the boneheads, consumers would benefit because the shutdown meant that FAA had to stop collecting the 7.5% tax on airline tickets, thus saving flyers up to $50 per round trip. Ha! Huh, fat chance of consumers ever catching a break from this gang. Sure enough, the week before the shutdown, airline honchos quietly began raising ticket prices by, you guessed it, 7.5% or more. So, the $50 per ticket that is supposed to help maintain and improve our nation's air travel infrastructure, instead, is siphoned straight into the bank accounts of American Airlines, Delta, Frontier, JetBlue, Southwest, and U.S. Air. Their ripoff adds up to some $30 million a day. This is Jim Hightower saying, perhaps you assume that this ripoff will stop once the FAA is back in action. Ha, again. Airline CEOs are nimble-fingered pickpockets who keep inventing new schemes for lifting money from workers and customers alike. They have no intention of rolling back this corporate tax. To help fight these greedheads, contact Transportation Workers Union, TWU.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Well, I know that somewhere down inside they're just feeling small and scared.
Do that. Yeah, and while you're hugging them, tell them, we don't need manufacturing. No, we don't need to make anything. Which, I got to be honest, you know, thanks to the caller, he has lit up our Facebook page with comments. Some of them make me laugh. David writes, an economy that has no manufacturing capability is a colony. And when I read that, I was thinking about one of those communes up north, up in the Poconos, Well, my wife and I went away for our anniversary. I saw in one of the supermarkets they had an advertisement advertising for a bartender. In this community, there was no cash. Everything was done on barter. So you had a bartender, and his job was to be the bartender. And maybe this is the utopian world that this kid's talking about. We don't deal with cash. We just all walk around and, you know, we do our job for free. And everybody does for us, and, you know, maybe that's the world that we're going to. Maybe, yeah, who knows? Not a bad thing. One of the other comments that I love, Jim, wants to share a story about a debate he had with some of the Ron Paul supporters at the CPAC convention. And he says, the story ends when somebody owns the air. Seriously, he says, the air. The reality is, at the rate that we're polluting, look what we've done with water. If 25 years ago you would have told me people would be spending $2-3 for a bottle of water, $5 for a bottle of water, I'd have told you you're crazy because they're drinking fountain right there. We've so polluted our water and so allowed our infrastructure to degrade, and they've done away with all the water fountains. People bottle water. Something that when I was a kid, you know, there was a drinking fountain basically everywhere. Even in the projects I grew up, they had a drinking fountain. But, boy, we've profitized water. And I guess the next step is profitize air. You want to breathe? You want to live? Going to cost you. I guess that is the radical right agenda, profitize everything. And I guess the question I ask, and, you know, I'd like an answer at some point from my the insaniacs, is this the world we want to live in? Do we want to live in a low-wage world where everything is privatized and everything is for sale? Everything is profitized. And then we continue to push down the price of labor by outsourcing jobs. I mean, I am just absolutely stunned that someone would say, we don't need to make anything. We can do services for each other. You know what the last service ends up being? The oldest profession in the book. Because eventually, and maybe our 23-year-old friend, maybe that's in his future down the road. Maybe when there's not a non-profit organization who can get money from the Koch brothers or from the wealth class, maybe that's where we'll find him.
Well, we joke about it, but, we've joked about it on this show, but really, if we get into a prolonged war, let's say eventually China becomes not only our chief economic adversary, but for economic reasons or for whatever, we get into a war with China. I mean, I don't think I'm exaggerating to say, you know, we might have a problem long-term conducting war. What are we going to do? Tell China, hey, you know, you got to give us a year to rebuild our defense industries. I mean, seriously, it's that serious. We have left so many industries that are basic to defense go that we are very much on the cusp of putting our security at risk.
I remember when I interviewed Hillary Clinton back when she was running for president. She said, and, you know, this is, and I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to refute what she said. She said that we have allowed the only company, and this was back, 2008, we had allowed at that time the only company who made the magnets for the navigation of the smart bombs to be sold to a Chinese company. They boxed up all the machinery. They shipped it all back to China, recreated the factory. And we now buy not only the chips that make our smart bombs smart, but also the magnets that they use at the tip to direct it. So in order to have smart bombs, we need smart chips and magnets. Without those, we have just bombs. That should scare people. But again, it's this, and maybe I'm going to become a radical right winger too. Maybe the education system is so broken in this country that you were able to get a 23-year-old to go through college and be brainwashed enough. Maybe the Koch brothers have done such a great job of buying professors. Maybe they've done such a great job of buying academia. Maybe we've done such a great job of privatized, profitized, and destroying university that now they're just brainwashing institutions for this bizarre free market world. Maybe we're living in the end days. Maybe I'm going to think about that over the weekend. Maybe the end of the world is that close.
Well, another situation, when you talk about defense, that huge contract, that huge defense contract for the new generation transport plane. If we give the contract to Airbus, first of all, they cheated like what. But beyond that, do we really want to trust France and some of the corporate interest? And by the way, the last I knew, France was the biggest exporter of weapons in the world. Do we really want to put that state-of-the-art technology that we use to defense our contract, or to defend our country, do we want to put that at risk by giving the contract to a foreign power? I mean, I understand France historically has been on our side, but they're not, even France, I would not trust with defense secrets that absolutely can put America at risk. But yet, for a few shillings, we were willing to do that, almost.
Yeah, man, I really. Anyway, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with former Congressman Bob Ney, Talk Radio News Service, right back after this.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? Thing, that's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair.
Officially in love with Michelle Bachmann, even if she's batshit crazy. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Ever check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Now that everything seems to be settling a little bit in Washington, everyone seems to be going home. Let's take a look at what's going on with Bob Nye, Talk Radio News Service. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks. How are you?
A little bit better. I think, you know, the dust's going to settle. We're going to see how this all plays out. I'm taking the position that the president lost. But what's amazing to me is that the right is kind of spinning it as they lost and Obama got exactly what he wanted. I've been reading a bunch of articles, and I guess it's a whole we need to be the underdog thing. I'm not sure.
I think, you know, President Obama, I think clearly if you put the categories together, lost. Look, Boehner, Speaker of the House, and McConnell, the minority leader of the Senate, are going to pick the select committee. So they can pick conservative Democrats. They can do what they want. And that's a biggie. There's a 50-50 cut that's going to trigger in if they don't, you know, the bipartisan committee doesn't do something. But that's 50% defense, 50% domestic. That's not going to happen. So there's going to be some forced issues. And how much can the president really lobby individual members? So, yeah, at the end of the day, I think in the loss category has to be a loss for the president. The liberals in the House are very, very upset. They're pretty vocal. But how you spin it that, oh, well, the president got everything he wanted, wow, that's pushing it.
Well, I mean, the one article I read, I think it was over at Red State, they said that Obama won because he got the Republicans to come out on the record of what they wanted to cut, and two, he got the debt ceiling raised until after the election. And I'm saying I'm not quite sure where that logic is coming because we've got these triggers. We've got this whole thing in December, which is going to be trouble. And he put Social Security on the table. I don't know how that helps him.
That one amazed me when the president first uttered anything near a concession on Social Security or Medicare. That was about, I think, 3 weeks ago. And then at first I thought, okay, well, he's really just, you know, trying to get something. He's kind of throwing that out. But at the end of the day, there's a difference between reform and a difference between cutting. And who knows what's going to come out of this thing. There's a lot of work yet to be done. But I think overall, yeah, Republicans lost on not getting the balanced budget amendment that they wanted, et cetera. But they definitely won a lot out of this, and I don't know how red state spins it that way.
Now, I mean, do you really think they had a shot at ever getting a balanced budget amendment? I mean, really?
No, I don't. And also, something nobody's talking about, if you get the thing, how on earth long is that going to take to actually pass into a constitutional frame? It could take forever.
And my other problem with it is how do you then deal with crisis when they arise? I mean, I look at what happened in September of 2008. And blame whoever you want. Blame Clinton, blame Bush. But at the end of the day, we had a massive collapse. We had to do some deficit spending to get the economy moving again, or at least keep us from collapsing, I think. With a balanced budget amendment, that doesn't happen.
I think also, just what I picked up on the streets and from D.C. and a little bit of paranoia by members of Congress I know on both sides of the aisle, that they kind of realize out front the American people kind of view this as a circus type of atmosphere, and why did it have to go down to the very, very wire? That's still lingering out there. Now, at the end of the day, they'll push for jobs. They'll push for FAA reauthorization. Those issues will go to the forefront. I think a lot of people from Boehner to Pelosi to President Obama, I think they all today say, well, let's move on to the jobs now. Everybody kind of wants to put this behind them, but it's gonna smack them in the face in December.
Well, my question with this, Bob, is why haven't we been talking about jobs all along? To me, if we talk about sane trade policies that encourage job growth here, we get the 14, 15 million unemployed people back, collecting a paycheck, paying taxes, I think all of our problems are solved. I mean, you look at our trade deficit. We have had a trade deficit with the rest of the world since 1975. We have not had a trade surplus since 1975.
We are letting foreign countries suck out every viable, good-paying job. The unions have been absolutely battered. The working people, period, have been battered. I couldn't agree with you more. Nobody is focusing on the real issue, which is, you know, we're losing our wallets in trade.
Now, I've been saying this throughout this whole discussion. This is a shiny thing. This is a distraction from the real problems, which is we've got to deal with China. China is eating our lunch, and we're basically serving it to them.
Absolutely. They got what they wanted with the world trade, which was an unholy deal between Gingrich and Clinton at the time, and they got what they wanted, and it was terrible. Once they did, you can't change their behavior. We don't even do a fair trade situation with them. They just step all over us. It's the most unimaginable thing I've ever seen. Yet nobody's out front during this, and I know the debt ceiling is a big deal, but nobody's talking about it. You're right, Rick. Nobody is talking about it.
You know what frustrates me, and this is off topic, but really frustrates me is the only people who are out there really fighting for jobs in this country are like the steel workers who had to take a trade case to the USTR to take to the WTO, and I'm going, wait a second, isn't that the company's job? Isn't that the country's job? Why do the steel workers have to do it?
They did out front, under Clinton and Bush, they fought the good fight, and it took a huge battle, and you can't do that with every single job, so the whole policy's got to be changed. The steelworkers, you know, did a good job, but not every person's capable of doing that.
Yeah, you know, as a congressman, you know, could you have imagined this kind of stuff going on, this kind of a debt ceiling fight during your years in Congress?
I think I voted four times, I think, and there was barely a peep on the thing. When this all started to bubble, I thought, well, where is this going? They're going to, oh, this is all smoke and mirrors. They're going to do this. And all of a sudden, I thought, this is real. They're actually going to take this one down to the wire. You know, the Tea Party movement, the people that were elected. But I think also, not just that push, but people themselves were extremely frustrated. This built into a hype of we're going to, you know, shut the government down. And it just got so much attention that I don't even think they could do the grand deal. Too many pressures were taking everybody in the wrong directions.
Yeah. Let's talk about the last thing, this FAA thing, because, again, you know, this is one of the, and I've been saying this is another one of those hostage situations where, because the Republicans didn't get what they wanted, shame on all of you, the 200,000 people who may be out on the street today, the 4,000 FAA workers, and, $2.5 billion worth of FAA projects that have stopped now, and all those employees onto the unemployment rolls, all because they couldn't get the anti-worker bill that they wanted, or the anti-worker piece of this reauthorization bill. All that stops.
Yeah, Ray LaHood is a great, great guy. I know him, you know, personally. I served with him. He's a very reasonable guy. He tried. He pushed. He did everything he could do. Rick, why this one just didn't move? 4,000 jobs, $30 million a day we're losing directly to the U.S. government. And this just is kind of micromanaging. I always have suspicions of prevailing wage issues secretly buried in this. You know, they don't want the construction at a certain cost. And it really doesn't make sense that this thing didn't pass. It really
makes no sense at all. But when you bring up prevailing wage, I mean, don't you want to build, and this is probably an ideological thing for you as well, but don't you want to have a local building trades industry in your community that is there, that is funded, that's able to build and to do the things that are good for communities, well, instead of a transient labor force that we see in a lot of the southern states?
You would think so. I mean, for me, this one's an easy one. I never failed the building trades in 11 years. I'm a building trades guy. I always was. And there are some Republicans who go along with that, but not enough attention is paid to the good-paying jobs, and all of a sudden you get these prevailing wage. And what do they want to do, take it down to minimum wage when the jobs are at 14 or 15 an hour?
That's what worries me.
Yeah, scary.
That's what worries me. Bob Ney, I appreciate the time. Always
Thanks.
Great talking to you. Thanks so much.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Former Congressman Bob Ney, Talk Radio News Service. Now to find out what's going on across the street, what do you got for us tonight, Jake?
Yeah, thanks a lot, Rick. Associated Press poll coming out about Obama and the current situation. New poll says that Pennsylvania voters believe that President Barack Obama behaved more responsibly than the Republican Congress during a drawn-out partisan showdown over the federal debt. But the Quinnipiac University poll released Tuesday also showed majorities disapprove of the way Obama and Congress handled the job situation. By a ratio of 44% to 37%, Pennsylvania voters said Obama acted more responsibly than the GOP in the debt debate. Obama's disapproval rating rose to 54%, while 2 out of 3 voters disapproved of the job done by both Democrats and Republicans in Congress. And it is true, this whole mess, Rick, in Congress has really turned off people's confidence in Congress, period.
But remember, that with the pledge, they were going to restore trust. They were going to restore the trust.
Well,
and create jobs. Yes, restore trust and create jobs. That's what they were going to do.
Let's be honest. Now, how many weeks has the nation's attention and Congress's attention, instead of doing exactly what we would prefer, talking about jobs, getting in the national discussion that we need. What did we talk about?
Talked about debt, man.
The debt limit.
See, we should be out there creating more nonprofit jobs. We should be creating more of those service sector jobs.
And as much as I didn't like to see it, I have to admit the Republicans probably, in the real political world, they probably came out a little bit ahead because they reached their objective, and that was to get money out of the president. And the bad thing is he lifted that lid, and now they got a playbook. The Tea Party has a playbook, and you can bet that playbook is going to be brought out again and again and again, and that's the sad part. Another report coming out of Harrisburg, a Patriot News, Harrisburg Mayor Linda Thompson's fiscal plan is going to use a commuter tax, as a bargaining chip. The plan that the mayor came up with would require Dauphin County, the state, and the bond insurance company that backed the city's incinerator debt to cover $26 million of stranded debt that Act 47 could have left Harrisburg with. If one or all of them, meaning the stakeholders, don't agree, a 2.2% to 2.5% commuter tax would be implemented. Like the Act 47 plan, Thompson's version calls for a sale of the city's incinerator and parking system lease. But any sale or lease of assets has to retire Harrisburg's $310 million of incinerator debt, whether stakeholders have a chip in it or not. I mean, to the mayor's credit, she's trying to get all the stakeholders to contribute something to Harrisburg's huge debt. There needs to be shared sacrifice to get the city out of this huge economic mess, and it just goes on and on and on. And at the end of the day, I'm afraid that the taxpayers in Harrisburg are gonna suffer for a long time, and hopefully the unions can protect their workers. Only time will tell, but in the end, I hope at least that the unionized workers can get a fair shake. Big story coming out of Washington, the big story of the day. The Senate votes 74-26 to pass emergency debt limit bill. The Senate passed emergency legislation Tuesday to avoid a first-ever government default, rushing the legislation to President Barack Obama for his signature just hours before the deadline. The vote was 74-26. Tuesday's vote capped an extraordinarily difficult Washington battle, pitting Tea Party Republican forces in the House against Obama and the Democrats controlling the Senate, resulting in compromise paired an essential increase in the government's borrowing cap with promises of more than $2 trillion budget cuts over the next decade. The measure would provide an immediate $400 billion increase in the $14.3 trillion U.S. borrowing cap with $500 billion.
Let's take a quick break. 1-888-520, Rick, back after this.
To the Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Workers in the late 1930s began exerting their recently guaranteed right to organize and join unions. Millions of workers flocked to join the labor organization of their choosing, to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, and working conditions. Factory, mill, and mine owners, not eager to embrace the changes, fought vehemently to deny workers their rights. As company tactics grew more heavy-handed and brutal, the workers' organizing methods changed. Sit-down strikes became a way for workers to demand their rights and to force management to listen. With a wave of a handkerchief, the tip of a hat, workers would shut down their machines, lay down their hammer, and sit down. Workers at the Hershey Chocolate Factory in Hershey, Pennsylvania, seeking to reduce the 60-hour-long work week, decided to form a union. Initially, an agreement was reached, but as the economy took a downturn, the company willfully violated the agreement by laying off the most senior workers, those who just happened to be the most ardent union supporters. The workers voted to strike the very next day. At 11 a.m. on April 2, 1937, a red handkerchief was waved and the workers began their first sit-down strike in Pennsylvania's history. The company reacted by forming the Loyal Workers Club. These strikebreakers consisted of hired thugs from New York City and local farmers, dairy producers, and shopkeepers who were dependent on the factory. On April 6, Hershey organized a loyalty parade. After hours of rallying speeches, the lathered-up Loyal Workers Club mob found pipes and clubs that had been manufactured at the Hershey planing mill. The angry mob headed to the Hershey factory to throw their strikers out. Songs of solidarity sung by the striking workers could be heard from inside the factory as the angry mob burst into the plant. Blocking the only exit, the Loyal Workers Club, loyal only to management and greed, began pummeling the workers as they tried to escape. The assault left numerous workers bloody and beaten, many unconscious. Within days, Hershey reopened and recognized the renamed version of the Loyal Workers Club. In May of 1938, the National Labor Relations Board ruled Hershey had violated the law and the company union was dissolved. Soon, the workers joined the Bakery and Confectionery Workers Local 464, who have faithfully represented the workers ever since. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. The Rick Smith Show.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can check out the website and download our podcast with a smartphone. You can download the Stitcher app and take Class War on the go with you. I'm still just amazed. We don't need no stinking manufacturing. Who needs to create any wealth? Who needs to create anything? We can create virtual wealth. We can continue that virtual stuff like we did on Wall Street.
I would really like, if the gentleman's listening, I would really like to call him back, you know, not to argue with the guy, but to really try to understand how he arrived at that thinking. I mean, did it come from a college professor? Did it come from his affiliation with one political party? Did it come from his parents, perhaps? Sometimes we inherit our parents' political attitudes, and sometimes we inherit our parents' political prejudices, too. That's not the first undergrad.
How did you come to your philosophy?
How? In the workplace?
I'm just going to go down that route. You know, this sounds like an exercise of mental masturbation. Good luck on that.
Well, I guess my point is I would really be interested as how he arrived at that astonishing point. That is perplexing. But it would be, on one level, it would be interesting to find out. And I wish he would call back.
There you go. Anyway, Mine Hill, New Jersey. I've spent a little time over here, and this is one of these things that you go, really, I missed this? New Jersey police evidently decided that they were going to watch the local Dunkin' Donuts, and gee, you know, cops, donuts, kind of mishes together there a little bit. They got an anonymous tip about one of the people working at the Dunkin' Donuts there, a woman named Melissa Redmond, 29. She worked the night shift, 9 p.m. to 5 a.m., and again, here again, you know, the service-based economy, you know, selling the donuts, didn't pay the bills, so she needed to take on a little extra work. The police say that she was, you know, spending about 10 or 15 minutes, you know, several times a night out in cars on the parking lot. And, of course, the police detective said, you know, sometimes we'd even see them changing hands. So I guess, you know, what they dubbed, the sting they dubbed extra sugar. They found out that the donut girl was, well,
so she's
powdering someone's.
Oh. So she sewed goodies with her donuts.
There you go. Yeah, there you go.
It is a service economy.
Right? There you go. And so where I'm going at, that's the service.
Right in.
But here's the thing. If they lived in Italy, the Italian court today reaffirmed the fact that having sex in a car is now a felony in Italy. So not only would she be charged with prostitution, it would be a felony to have sex in a car. And I got to be honest, I don't think I agree with that. I mean, where are most teenagers going to, do that whole deal?
I think the irony is Italy. I mean,
Italy.
The Italians were, historically very romantic.
And, the thing is they can be sentenced from 3 months to 3 years in prison.
Wow.
And I go, at the end of this, who pushed this through? Was this the hotel lobby? Was this the by-the-hour motel lobby out there pushing? We're not selling enough cheap rooms.
I guess my question
is... selling enough by-the-hour rooms.
What's the law's definition of having sex in a car?
I guess being naked and the... I don't know what their definition is. They just said these two were caught naked having sex in the car. Are you going to go Bill Clinton on me now? What's the definition? What does is mean?
Well, that could be a broad definition.
There you go. 54-year-old carpenter in England. And again, this is one of those ones you go, would you file this under workman's comp? Is it possible? 54-year-old carpenter there in England, he was doing a little work and he was sawing away, sawing wood, and oops! He chopped off his own penis. Yeah. His mother said, Stuart's a carpenter. He uses sharp tools and sometimes dangerous tools. This was an unfortunate accident, but things happen all the time to people in his profession. I don't know. And maybe if there are any carpenters out there, have you ever chopped off your own penis? I don't know.
Ooh.
And again, I wonder, would workman's comp cover it? And then what would you be compensated for?
I guess my question is, did they sew it back?
I don't know. I didn't
ask. That it has been done.
Ask John Wayne Bobbitt or whatever his name was. Wasn't that what it was?
No, not John Wayne Bobbitt. I know who you mean.
It was John Wayne Bobbitt. Don't tell me it wasn't. You're thinking John Wayne Gacy. The wife took it down the road.
It was right? Bobbitt, but was it John Wayne?
Yeah, I believe it was.
Okay.
Another interesting story coming out of the wonderful, wonderful state of New York, Brooklyn. Evidently, the school there at PS 13 in Brooklyn, New York, decided they were going to show the movie Camp Rock. It's a Disney Channel movie with the Jonas Brothers. The teachers put the film in and went back and went to sit down with the students and some of these kids as young as 5 years old. We're sitting there watching, not Camp Rock, Camp something else, hardcore porn on the screen. They saw probably anywhere between 45 seconds and a minute of what was going on there. And of course, the kids were traumatized. Personally, when I looked at this, Camp Rock, the movie with the Jonas Brothers, I'm sure the porn had more of a plot and probably better acting. But here's the thing. And speaking of the Jonas Brothers movie, there's another bad movie. In the state of Washington, Federal Way, Washington, the police arrested a guy who evidently, and I'm trying to figure out how this all worked, evidently he was using his genitals as a puppet while he was standing over an air conditioner over the intake of the apartment complex that he lived in. So he's kind of playing puppet, and I'm trying to figure out how that works. But there he was. The police are on 10:30 in the morning. Arrested him, took him to jail. He will be charged, also charged with having methamphetamine. So maybe that had something to do with it. Interesting story out of Miami. They found a bunch of bees. We've been hearing the story. There's not enough bees. They found a beehive with some 3 million bees in it. Can you imagine how big this thing must have been? The beekeeper said, 20-year career, never seen anything as large. And what was going on is that these bees were stinging people, because that's what bees do. And the beekeeper said, it's not surprising. These are Italian bees. So, again, I go back and I go to our earlier story. Maybe because they couldn't have sex in cars. I don't know. But here you go. They're a bit more aggressive, he says. So, they said it would produce about 60 pounds of honey. They moved it to a nearby farm. So there you go. And, we were worried about the bees. Now we know where they are, Florida. And the other thing is I just found a huge beehive by my house. We were doing some work on the AC unit, and damned if there wasn't a huge wasp nest there. Here's a good story. You might want to jump right into this one. This kid in Britain, he has officially changed his name to Captain Fantastic, faster than Superman, Spider-Man, Batman, Wolverine, Hulk, and the Flash combined. I don't know that that's really a joke there. It's kind of sad. Turns out Granny, you know, his grandmother, will never speak to him again. And he said he did it because he wanted to be unique. And he decided upon the superhero theme, paid $20 fee, got his name changed officially. Have you ever seen the movie with Steve Carell, that movie, The 40-Year-Old Virgin?
Yes.
Did you ever see that? 21 years from now, there's going to be a sequel. Because this kid, in 21 years when he's 40, we're going to see the sequel. Wow, what would possess you?
You mean the name will scare women away? Is that what you're saying?
No, I think most women will go, you're just pathetic. And really, I am Captain Fantastic, faster than Superman, Spider-Man, Wolverine, Batman, Hulk, and the Flash combined. Hello, Mrs. Fantastic, faster than Superman, Spider-Man, Batman. Yeah, she's going to write that down on her on a marriage form. Yeah, that's going to happen. Good luck on him, Mr. Soon-to-be 40-year-old virgin. Jeez Louise. Anyway, I want to thank everyone on the program this evening, especially our good friend Mike Morrell, Executive Director of Keystone Progress. And, you know, I go back to that thing with Alec. Again, you know, I can't stress it enough at how distressing it is that we have legislators who are basically just cutting and pasting other people's work, and we're paying them. This is one of those moments where I think a full-fledged investigation should happen, along the lines of the bonus thing, along the line of all the bonuses that they were giving out in the pay raise. This is important stuff. This is about actually how government works. I mean, it's no surprise that the people who don't believe in it, the people who despise government and tell you at every turn that they're willing to destroy it, do things like this. It's no surprise. It is surprising that people vote for them. But I'm hoping that this kind of stuff will wake folks up and say, you know what, this isn't what I voted for.
And here's where, for democracy to work, Rick, those voters in the districts where these representatives and senators come from, they have to confront these people. Demand an explanation.
Or take them out to the woodshed.
Or better yet,
could switch and
vote them out.
Yeah, well, you know, we need more service sector employees. So maybe they can go and work at the mall. Good thing. And I also want to thank Kenneth Schmidt, Professor of Labor and Employment Law at Indiana University, for one, writing a great piece on the No Rights at Work agenda, and two, coming on talking to us about the issue. Because, look, we're going to be fighting this here. There's no question. The mad cow himself has proposed House Bill 50, 51, 52, 53, which they're going to be hearing on August 16th at 1 o'clock here in the Capitol. And, you know, this is it. This is the real stuff. These are the fights that we saw happen in Wisconsin. These are the fights that we saw happen in Ohio. Fortunately, Ohio's kind of turning it back. They're going to get it on the referendum. They're going to get it on the ballot, and I guarantee you they're going to overturn it. Much like they did with the really draconian workers' comp stuff they tried to do a couple of years ago. I have full faith and confidence in my former home state that they're going to do the right thing here. But here we don't have that luxury. We are going to have to bat this back right from the start. And it's going to take you, it's going to take me, it's going to take conscious people to say, you know what, we're not going down, we're not going to be Alabama or Georgia or Mississippi. We're not going to be there. It's not going to happen. Also want to thank Michael Winship, president of the Writers Guild of America East, for his conversation on the class war that's going on from the top down, them against us. You know, like Buffett says, you know, it's class war going on. His class is winning, but they shouldn't be. And of course, Nora Flores Lopez, director of the Children in the Fields campaign at the Association of Farm Worker Opportunity Programs. You know, this child labor thing. Tomorrow is the day the Delosier bill is going to come up for discussion. We'll be talking about it tomorrow night again, but this is where you call your representatives and say, hey, not in favor of these changes. not in favor at all. Anyway, I hope you have a great night. We'll see you back here tomorrow, as every night, 9 to midnight. Have a good night. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tireless flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. Democracy is coming.
The Rick Smith Show. The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.